There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
Lowe's knows when you're looking for reliability, the right brand makes all the difference. And now, Lowe's is the exclusive home improvement retailer for the Whirlpool water treatment line, including their Wi-Fi softener, under-sink filtration system, and more. With Whirlpool's proven performance and our everyday low prices, better tasting, better quality water is within reach. Shop pro-trusted brands like Whirlpool and more, in-store or online. Lowe's. We help. You save.
We have got another one in our ex-police series today. They're doing extremely well, all of our ex-cop playlist interviews. And going back, I think, what was it, Neil Woods was one of the first we had on. He's got hundreds of thousands of views now on his. And, you know, we've interviewed a lot of people who've been to prison, a lot of people have been through trauma, people have been in crime. And the cops go through all that as well. If you look at some of the interviews we've done within days, you know, the attending houses where there's corpses or fatalities, car crashes, and the catalogue of the horrific things that they see is perhaps more than, you know, any other profession, or perhaps ambulance drivers, soldiers, stuff like that. So endless fascination in the stories coming from the ex-cops. And today we've got Matt Calverley, whose book is called Cops and Horrors. And before we introduce you to Matt, I'll just read some from the back. As a decorated officer on the police front line, Matt saw it all. He fought violent criminals, arrested hundreds, dealt with numerous horrific incidents, and got bitten by a squirrel monkey called Clive. In Cops and Horrors, he recalls the hair-raising highs and harrowing lows during 30 dedicated years of Metropolitan Police Service, in which 2 days were never the same. During this time, he worked at the sharp end as a custody sergeant, provided jury protection during a huge corruption trial, and was involved in countless white-knuckle car chases, including one involving a rogue Santa Claus driving a flashy limo.
As you do.
From confronting a machete-wielding maniac working undercover to catch the Mardi Gras bomber, dealing with grieving relatives and catastrophic road death scenes, it wasn't a job for the faint-hearted. And we ask people when we're screening them, can you come with at least 20 stories? Matt's got 340. So it might be a series in the making here.
Well, can we please start with the squirrel monkey called Clive?
And huge thank you for coming on
and
as well.
And yes, thank you for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah.
No problem.
Clive was a Sunday morning emergency call, which I repeatedly declined. Sunday mornings are prime times for practical jokes. And in the central London, a woman complains a monkey has climbed through a kitchen window. You're like, no, this is not happening, no. Control room insisted. So eventually my colleague Bob and I, we went to the scene. Very nice house in the west side of Shepherd's Bush. And this lady said, oh, come in. Yeah, it's in the kitchen. So I went into the kitchen and then sat on the kitchen worktop was a fluorescent green and yellow squirrel monkey eating a hard-boiled egg that she'd given it. So I said, what the hell? Where did that come from? And she said, no idea. I was doing the washing up. It climbed through the window. Okay, so my colleague Bob, he went outside to make some radio calls to ask for advice from the RSPCA, London Zoo, anybody else they could think of. Being a Sunday morning, most people weren't answering the phone. So I was sort of a little bit bewildered in this kitchen, and I said to them, this was 1987, I'd only been in the police less than 2 years, so I was quite new to it all, and I said to this lady, is it tame? And she said, yes, it's clearly domesticated, it's been playing with the children and so on. So I tentatively approached it and offered my hand, which was okay. It held my fingers with its little hands and then suddenly jumped on my hand, ran up my arm, sat on my shoulder, still eating a hard-boiled egg.
Where did he get the hard-boiled egg from?
Oh, she'd given it to her. Making it for lunch or something, and she'd given it. She'd look it around for something to give it to distract it. So I'm there, a police officer in full uniform with a monkey sat on my shoulder eating an egg. And I thought, what should we do with it? So the lady's husband came in with a big cardboard box he'd found in the garage and said, well, let's put it in here until we know what to do with it. So without thinking, I went, that's a good idea. Lifted my hands up to take hold of this monkey. Really, really bad idea. And it dropped the egg and just sank its teeth straight into my thumb. So I grabbed it around the neck and ripped it away. And then... yeah, it scurried off and hid behind a kitchen unit. And then I looked down and my left thumb was hanging off at the knuckle.
Oh!
And there was blood spurting everywhere. So I remember then the floor coming up to meet me as I blacked out from the loss of blood. And then the next thing I knew, my colleague Bob had obviously shoulder carried me into the police car, thrown me onto the back seat. And I woke up hearing sirens as he was screaming up to the hospital. And then... straight to hospital at Hammersmith Hospital in Shepherd's Bush. We had a great relationship with them. I was seen straight away. And it was, thumb was sewn back together. And it was about 6 months till I got full use of it. And it was over a year till I got the nerve endings reconnected. I still got the scar around the knuckle. And then a couple of weeks later, I find myself in the local Gazette because Bob, my colleague, who was never one to miss an opportunity, had anonymously phoned them and said, you know, one of your local officers had his thumb bitten off, nearly off by a monkey. So in the middle of the book is the actual press cutting from 1987.
Fantastic.
Good grief.
The monkey had, while this commotion was going on, headed back to the open window and scurried off and disappeared, and it made its way home. It lived a few doors away. It was a domestic pet. Owner had left the cage open. And the reporter from the Gazette, with a bit of diligence, tracked her down and spoke to her about it. And then it appeared in the local paper. So it was my first scar. In fact, my only scar I picked up in the 30 years in the police, and it didn't even come from a person. Yeah. So,
sorry.
So the monkey was okay in the end.
Yeah.
Well, I believe so. I think I had my tetanus jab. I don't know what the monkey got. Yeah.
And someone just been keeping it as a pet, and then it just escaped. And
domesticated pet.
So does it go back to that person? Or does it have to go to the zoo?
It had gone back home, and then, as far as I know, she got on with its life.
I didn't even know you could have monkeys.
No, I didn't. No. Live and learn.
Good choice of first story, Jen.
Definitely.
Let's go back then to what you were like as a teenager. Did you plan on becoming a cop when you grew up? Or?
I always wanted to. I was a big fan of TV cop shows, you know, Starsky and Hutch and Juliet Bravo and so on. But I was never physically suited to the police. I shot up very quickly to 6'3", but didn't put the weight on. And I was very, very skinny, quite frail as a child, as a teenager. So although it was a dream and ambition, it never seemed that likely, essentially.
So what changed that?
Well, when I got to my late teens, I, as I mentioned in the book, I think I, myself, my friend, when we were 14, we were trying to find a lost football. We ended up getting chased by the police across a few gardens and easily outrun this guy and escaped. And I remember thinking afterwards, that was a pretty poor show by the police. I think if I'd been him, I wouldn't have let me escape. I'd have caught me. And then you roll on a few years, and I thought, well, I'll try and get in the police. So I applied to Lancashire Constabulary, and they sent it straight back and said, you've got to be 21, you're only 19. So that's a typical lack of detail. I didn't bother checking, you know. And then I saw an advert for the Met that were you could apply at 18 and a half. So I thought, well, do I really want to move to London and, you know, join the big city? And I thought, well, why not? You know, I didn't expect to get anywhere, but I sent the application form off. And then the selection process lasted a year. It was quite a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. And the bit that nearly became my Achilles heel was my height and weight. Because I filled in the form with all honesty, which is my first mistake. Sent it back. And the Met then sent a form to me saying, we're questioning your height and weight ratio. Can you please take this form to your local police station? Have them measure your height and weight, certify it, send it back here. And I thought, well, I'm screwed. You know, I'm not. The Met at the time had strict height and weight requirements.
Why is that?
I think it was the sort of 80s, 70s, 80s image of an authority figure, a police officer. You know, you had to be sufficient physical strength, sufficient height to command a presence. I had the height, but nothing else. So I went to my local police station, very downhearted, and this very obliging sergeant behind the counter, a guy called Sergeant Steele, looked at the form. He measured my height, he measured my weight, and he said, "You know, well, you're 10 stone 8. That's your underweight. That's not going to be enough to get you in." And my heart sank. He said, "I'll put 11 stone 6." And he put 11 stone 6 down. I said, "That's amazing." He said, "Yeah, just make sure you load up on pies before you..."
Of course.
So, and then I was called down to London for the 2 days election, and I had loaded up on pies, but I struggled to gain weight. I hadn't gained any weight. So when it came to being reweighed and remeasured, I thought, I'm going to flunk this again unless I do something.
Sandbags.
Yeah. I can't gain weight, but can I lose height? So I did. I lost some height. When they came to measure me, I just dropped myself a little bit in this big suit I was wearing. And they measured me at 6'1" instead of 6'3". And that they plopped me on a graph, and that puts me right on the borderline between acceptable and underweight. Wow. So I then scurried out before they decided to check the figures. So with a bit of creative weighing and measuring, I got through the first hurdle. And then 3 months later, I was in. I was heading down to London.
So you said Lancashire. I was born in Lancashire. What part of Lancashire?
I was born in Lytham. It's called Lytham St. Towners, but if you're from Lytham, you like to call it Lytham.
Yeah. So transitioning to London then at a young age, was that daunting?
Yes, it was. I was unbelievably naive. During our initial training, when I started at Shepherd's Bush, one of the instructors said, "We've got a fairly dodgy housing estate. It's called the White City. If you get a call there, if you need to arrest somebody, make sure you back up and your van is all there because it can kick off." And when he said the words housing estate, my mind pictured an image of Lytham Hall Park, which is a housing estate in Lytham, but it's massive detached bungalows with big gardens. And it's to me, that was what a housing estate looked like. I had no idea what a housing estate really was like. And that was my first wake-up call to how naive I was moving from a little northern town to the big city.
So what was your accommodation like when you got there?
Well, the first 20 weeks I was at Wanstead in East London in the training school. And it was there was a photo of my room actually in the book on the 7th floor. It was basic, but you know, adequate. It had a bed and a desk and a wash basin, which I'm told for some people doubled as a urinal, but I can't comment on that.
Nice.
Looks not much different from a prison cell.
It's probably slightly smaller, I think. Smaller than a prison cell, yeah. And communal showers on the same floor, you know, and that sort of thing. And then when I finished my training, I was posted to Paddington Green Section House in central London on the 11th floor, which was a room slightly smaller than that, with a view of 9 lanes of traffic outside the window, the Marylebone flyover, the Edgware Road, and it was so totally different from growing up in a
picturesque
little town, seaside town. And the only time I would ever experience actual silence was when I went home for a weekend. So I'd spend three, four weeks in London, constant noise, either on duty or in my accommodation. And then going home was the only way I could get peace and quiet.
So what were your workmates like back then?
There were a proper mixed bunch. At Shepherd's Bush, there was some very inspirational characters. There's one chapter dedicated to my colleague Bob, who I say he's passed away now, but he, when I think he joined the police in 1962, he was very, a proper old sweat. Lost none of his enthusiasm for frontline policing. I learnt an awful lot from him, in particular how much I really, really wanted to drive fast cars the way he drove them. And there are other colleagues for whom probationers are seen as a burden. You just, if you're posted with them, you just know to keep your mouth shut and do what you're told. And there's some who fell foul of their own laws and end up getting kicked out, arrested. Drink drive was a common downfall. But generally speaking, a really, really good bunch.
How soon before you encountered a corpse?
I was probably about, I did my, I think, six months basic training, 10 weeks street duties. So probably about 9 months in when I got sent to my first sudden death. And it was the one where an elderly chap been up on his roof, 82 years old, up on his roof of his two-story house, fixing a loose tile. He was very, very sprightly. It appears from the post-mortem he'd had a massive heart attack on the roof.
Oh, no.
So he was probably dead before he hit the ground, but he landed on a, he'd come down off the roof vertically, landed on his head, and his head had been pushed down his spine like a cocktail onion on a stick, in front of his wife. She was in the this big patio doors through to the dining room. She sat in the dining room while he's up on the roof, and all of a sudden she sees, choom, he just lands on his head in front of the patio doors, splattering the patio doors with blood and brain tissue.
Something from a horror movie.
Yeah. So I turned up just as the ambulance crew were leaving, and they were like, it's not one for us, because they don't remove dead people, they just remove the living. And then so I took the widow in, well, the widow, new widow, into the front room away from it, and I said, I'm just going to go and do some investigation, I'll be right back. So I went out the back onto the patio, and it was a scene from a horror movie, as you said. It was comforting subsequently to know that he was dead before he'd even hit the floor. And then the undertakers came and they picked up the body and took it away. And then I realised there's a problem here, because neither the undertakers nor the paramedics are responsible for cleaning up. In fact, it's actually down to the widow. And I thought, this is not okay. You know, not having her cleaning her husband's brains and blood from the patio and the patio doors. So I got the garden hose out, hosed it all the way onto the flower beds, figuring it couldn't do any harm. Cleaned it all up. Next of kin had been called. She was on her way from a county on the train down to London. Their daughter. When she was in the good hands of neighbours, I left her to it, went and wrote my report, and thought nothing more of it until about a year later, when, again, somebody sort of passed me a local paper in the police station. And it was about an elderly widow who'd been tending a garden in the spring and had dug up a set of false teeth.
Oh.
That looked suspiciously like her late husband's. And I'm sort of thinking, well.
No way.
I thought, well, almost certainly me. I thought, because I mean, there's all the mess. There was bone fragments, blood, brain. I just hosed the whole lot into the garden and dug it over a bit. And I thought, my first thought was, can I get in trouble for this? But I didn't, fortunately. You know, she seemed to sort of take it in good humour, but you think these things, no 2 days are the same, and you think that a day's finished, you move on to the next thing, and then a year later this comes back to, I would say comes back to bite you, but that'd be a con too far.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, well.
So arriving at that scene and absorbing what you saw, did that affect you psychologically, or were you steeled and trained to encounter things like that?
It didn't affect me psychologically, which I was quite surprised about. We had my journey to get to this point of death was at training school. They showed us various photo albums, one of which still has a question mark hanging over it, which I can come back to. The second one was we went to see a post-mortem, which I found absolutely fascinating, because the anatomy of the body and how it all fits together and works, I found very
fascinating. Could you take us through that, what you saw at the post-mortem?
Post-mortem, yeah. There was myself and my seven colleagues who were all dispatched from training school to Shepherd's Bush. We went to Fulham Mortuary. We were shown in by the pathologist. There were three bodies laid out. There was a woman in her 40s who'd had a heroin crack overdose. Mm. There was a 8-month-old cot death victim.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's really sad.
And yeah, and the third table was a man in his 80s who'd died of heart attack, natural causes, and that was the one they were going to do. So we all stand around, all looking a little bit pale. For most of us, it was the first time we'd seen a body, and now we're about to see one dismantled before our eyes. So it was a case of deep breath, you know. And so it's not a pathologist at first, it's a mortuary technician who prepares the body, then the pathologist comes in and does the examination. So the technician was talking us through, cuts open the chest like a zip down the scalpel, bolt croppers to take the ribs out and the sternum, and then takes out the individual organs one at a time, puts them in steel bowls, they get weighed, and then subsequently examined. And I was fine with all this. I was fascinated by how it all fits together. There was a couple of my colleagues were looking a bit green, but and then came the head. And so this is where I learned something. The technician, he cut around the back of the scalp, and then I didn't know the face is not attached to the skull. It just literally just peels off. So having done the cut, just rolled the skin forward, and the whole face just rolls off.
Oh,
it's not attached.
It's not attached. I never knew the face is not attached to the skull.
I never knew that.
No. So, and then he said, now we need to get the brain out. So he got a circular saw and started to cut around the top of the skull to get the brain out. And this is where I reached my limit when a piece of bloody gristle flew off the saw, hit me on the cheek.
Oh.
So I got a lump of bloody gristle bone on my cheek. So I just ran to the sink and started scrubbing like it was nuclear fallout and paper towels and rubbed it away. And then I sort of, I'm done. I sat on a chair and I'll sit the rest of this one out.
Was anyone sick?
Yeah, one guy was like leaning over the sink. I don't know if he was actually sick, but he's certainly leaning over the sink in preparation. And that was my my wake up to the true horrors that awaited me.
So the face is just like a rubber mask.
It's just a rubber mask.
It peels off.
Yeah, rolls off. Leaves the eyes behind. But
oh,
yeah, that's it's really quite freaky.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, it was quite freaky.
Did you see anything? The 8-month-old get cut open then?
No, we just saw didn't. This one. They had three.
That'd be too much. That one.
Yes,
yeah, that would be horrendous.
Three on the tables, ready for. We were going to do three, one after the other, but we only stayed for the first one, which was the old man, who was considered to be the least traumatic of the three.
So do you think you're naturally predisposed then to deal with the macabre? And
it became apparent, yes. I've always found I was better dealing with the blood and gut side of a death than the traumatic emotional family side and trying to support bereaved families, never knowing what to say or trying not to put my foot in it. I was better just leave me with the body and I'll deal with that.
When was the first time you had to go tell a family?
The first time was when I was on my 10-week street duties course. There's two of myself and another constable, a guy called Dave. We went to deliver a death message to a lady whose husband had been killed in a car crash. He'd gone down to Hampshire to work and he'd been killed in a car crash. We used to take it in turns with jobs. It wasn't my turn to do this one, I'm really pleased about, but we called this block of flats, got this lady at the door, and my colleague launched straight into, I'm really sorry to tell you, your husband's been killed and he's in a car crash this morning. And she sort of collapsed in tears and then said, did you say car crash? And he said, yes, in Hampshire. And she said, he got the train into London this morning. And then we checked the door, we were at the wrong flat.
Oh my God!
Yeah, so due diligence, I kind of took a back seat for that one. And I'm really glad it wasn't me that did that. It was his turn. So you could say that's my first experience of how not to do a death message, I think.
Most definitely.
Because imagine if she like had a heart attack on that news or something.
Yeah.
Well, you can imagine she might have started crying or not.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In that first year then, you know, what challenges presented themselves to you or what situations were
out of your 340 dicey. Stories?
Out of my 340 stories.
In the early years, what were the major ones?
I think it's a case of doing the first sudden death, the first foot chase, the first arrest for this, the first arrest for that. Because each time you arrest somebody for a different offence, you're completely out of your comfort zone. You take them before the custody sergeant, you don't know what to say, you don't know what the elements are you should be saying. My first arrest for driving while disqualified was I recognised the car driving towards me. It had been on the daily briefing as being owned by a disqualified driver. So I stopped the car, the guy got out, asked him for his name. He gave me a name that I knew was false. So I challenged him and he turned and sprinted away. So I chased after him onto the White City estate and he made it to his front door, tried to shut it but failed. I barged in and arrested him, handcuffed him, took him before the custody sergeant, job done, so I thought, told the custody sergeant, and he sort of, bear in mind I was at this point, I'd only a few months service, put his pen down, folded his arms, looked at me in front of the prisoner and said, wrong.
What?
That was that. And I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? He's disqualified driver, Sarge. I've arrested him for driving a car on the road while disqualified. And he said, yeah, but this, the law only allows a power of arrest in immediate pursuit. And I said, well, I chased him all the way to his front door and arrested him after the chase. I never lost sight of him. And Simon's like, well, you didn't say that, did you? And then carried on. So embarrassing probations in front of prisoners seems to be a bit of a sport.
Mm. Oh, my God. So that was the foot chase then, did you say?
Yes.
So what was the next? Like, did you have to get in fights with people and stuff like that and rough and tumble stuff?
Well, actually, what was your, yeah. Can you remember your first arrest?
My first arrest was using a technique called the five negatives, which I was on foot patrol a few weeks into my street duty training course, and the inspector pulled up alongside in his car, and he was a very brusque northerner. He said, "Oi, you had an arrest yet?" I'm like, "Not yet, sir, no." He said, "Right, get in, we'll go and get one." he said, "Do you know what the five negatives are?" I'm like, "Nope." He said, "Right," he said, you stop a car, your first negative is no tax disc. Obviously, cars used to have tax discs, you know, now they don't, but they do used to. If the car's got no tax disc or it's out of date, you pull the car over. That's your first negative. You ask the driver, has he got his driving license on him? If he hasn't, that's the second one. Ask him, has he got any other identification on him? If he hasn't got any identification on him, that's your third negative. Your fourth one, is his name and address the same as the registered owner of the car? If that's a no, you're on to the fifth one, which is, can he tell you who the registered owner of the car is? And if you have no to all those five questions, you just arrest the driver. I said, what are you arresting for? He said, whatever you want. Stealing the car, driving disqualified, no insurance, it's bound to be something. And he was absolutely right. So I took this first guy, who the car had no tax disc, went through the five negatives and took him in. And I said to the custody sergeant, this is why I've arrested him, blah, blah. And I started waffling, and the custody sergeant said, look, was it five negatives? I said, yes, sergeant. Right, okay, what's all I need to know? And the guy eventually said, okay, fine. He says, I got no tax. I can't get tax because I got no insurance. I got no insurance because I'm on a ban for drink driving. I shouldn't be driving. And I thought, bingo, system worked. Five negatives works. He's a disqualified driver. And he got a month in prison and an extra year on his ban, I think. And that was my first arrest. And from then on, I used five negatives numerous times. And every single time, there was some law being broken every time.
Course.
What was your first like really hairy moment or like close shave?
The machete attack was a fairly close shave. There was a guy in the news recently called Stuart Otten, I think, who's dubbed Britain's toughest cop. He was proper attacked with a machete. Mine wasn't anywhere near that level. Mine was a call to a neighbour disturbance one evening in a quite residential street in Shepherd's Bush, and I walked down this very dark street. I didn't know at the time, this one guy had pulled a machete out and the other guy had run indoors and locked the door. So I'm walking into a situation where there's just one guy. It was very dark. I couldn't see what's going on. Then I saw this guy start sharpening machete on the garden wall, swiping it backwards and forwards. So I sort of, against my better judgment, which should have been to back off and get some backup armed response or dog handler or something, I challenged him. And he charged straight towards me with his machete raised. And the only thing that saved me was the fact that he was absolutely bladdered. He could barely stand, let alone run. So he was very wobbly on his feet. So I managed to block his blow, and he dropped the machete and I handcuffed him and everything. And he was swearing about the neighbour having an affair with his wife and blah, blah, blah. So he was quite an older chap, in his 60s. So that was my... Afterwards, I remember thinking, Christ, you know, I could have been killed. I could have lost an arm or a leg. I thought, well, could I? You know, he was clearly very inebriated. But I thought, yeah, I should have backed off, but I didn't. Anyway, my sergeant submitted me for a commendation for that. And he got as far as the desk jockey chief inspector, who said, no, the guy was drunk and he was 60. How much damage could he really have caused with a machete? I'm like, okay, you keep your 9-to-5 desk job and let the rest of us do the front line.
Yeah.
So this chap to think like a criminal.
Can I quickly have a... I'm going to whip to the toilet.
Yeah, I'll keep going. Think like a criminal.
Yes.
What happens in that chapter?
That was trying to get inside criminals' heads and sort of work out if you're trying to investigate a crime, work out what would they have done. You know, would it be, because most crime is opportunistic. There's a story later on where I was sent to a burglary, which turned out to be not all it seemed. I went to this basement flat. There'd been no sign of forced entry. It's like the door had been left open. It was actually a trap, an integrity trap.
What?
For, could have been anybody. They just asked for any offers. I've leapt ahead a bit here, but I'll rewind a bit. I was quite adept at this point at breaking into houses. I'd learnt a lot of skills from a locksmith at bypassing door locks. I was very knowledgeable about methods of door, car, house and car security. And the reason is because back then, if police used force entry to break into a property, you then had to wait with it until the owner came home, which could be many, many hours. I would rather break in without damage and then just lock it up. Anyway, this particular story on one morning, the control room asked for any officer available to report a burglary, which is how I knew it wasn't targeted at me. So I volunteered, went to report this burglary in this basement flat. And I thought, this isn't right. There's been the doors and there's no damage to the lock. I knew that burglars at this time, they used to just shoulder barge a door, usually to find quick sell stuff to fund drug habits. So I was sort of a bit suspicious. I went in, this flat had been ransacked. TV and video cabinet was empty. There was drawers tipped out. And there was a big pile of banknotes on top of some clothing, about £400. I thought, there's no big, a burglar couldn't, you couldn't miss that.
So a house had been burgled, sorry.
Yeah, flat, yeah. Basement flat being burgled. Okay. It didn't add up. Yeah, so anyway, I did what I was supposed to. I scooped up the money and bagged it. I called scenes of crime down to do fingerprints. I secured the place, which just meant dropping the Yale latch and closing the door. Booked the property, the money into the safe at the police station, and then wrote my report and left it at that and thought nothing more about it. And then checked a week later and the money had been signed for by a senior officer from an unknown covert department at Scotland Yard. And then the penny dropped. This was an integrity test, which was done from time to time to try and root out corrupt officers. They'll set up this crime, ask for anybody to go and deal with this, knowing, you know, and then if they go in afterwards and the money's gone and they check the books and it's not being booked in, then you're banged to rights. You know, there's money gone missing from this crime scene. It's all, the audit trail is there and you're in deep trouble. I'll be honest, never crossed my mind to take even a penny of it because that wasn't on my radar, never has been. But it was crudely done, as in there was no forced entry. There was no way a burglar could have missed this pile of money. Why would you take a TV you're going to get 25 quid for when there's £400 in cash lying on the floor? So that was, I forgot what the question was now. Was it?
Think like a criminal.
Think like a criminal, yes. Try and work out that one. A burglar hasn't come in here. A burglar would not have been able to use the quite skilled methods to bypass door locks in a basement flat that's out of view of the street. They just barge their way in, basically.
What was your first encounter with a corrupt cop then?
Corrupt cop. There was he wasn't a cop. He was a member of civilian staff. There was plenty of cops along the way. But this, the first encounter was a civilian member of staff who used to do the shift work running the front office. And one of his colleagues used to sort of have a laugh about him. She said, whenever I'm running the front office, there's always all these women phoning up for him by name, asking for him by name. And I think, yeah, she said, he just must be such a gigolo.
Player. This guy.
Yeah, real player. Mm. No, he was part of an illegal immigrant smuggling ring. His role of this gang was to find safe houses in London. And with unbelievably breathtaking arrogance, he'd given them the phone number of the police station to contact him. This was before pre-mobile phones, obviously. So the women all ringing up to speak to this guy to sort out their accommodation, having come in the back of lorries or whatever.
Wow.
And he was, but he was under investigation at the time, and he was jailed and kicked out.
That is brave to give the police station number.
Unbelievable, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Alcohol is a downfall of a lot of officers. You know, a guy who I turned up for a late shift walked into the locker room one day and there's a police officer unconscious on the floor in full uniform with a bearded stranger standing over inside the police station in the locker room. And I sort of, I'm almost straight into combat mode. You know, I thought, what's going on here? And this guy, this stranger, very quickly introduced himself. He's the licensee of a local pub, an Irish, a Dublin pub. And the officer was the local beat officer for that area. And he said he came and he's been in my pub drinking all morning in uniform. He said, and I shut up for an hour at lunchtime or after lunch. He said, and I came out and he was lying in the gutter, unconscious, in full uniform. He said, so I slung him in my truck, drove him to the police station. I didn't know what to do with him. So I was like, does anybody know you're here? He said, oh yeah, his sergeant knows, he's dealing with it. So I'm like, fine, I don't want to know anymore. And I left him to it. And this same guy, a few months later, he crashed into parked cars in his own car while he was drunk and he was kicked out.
Wow.
I think that's a reaction to like self-medicating for the trauma that they mm-hmm. go through yeah. and see
absolutely,
things,
yeah.
dark things.
Yeah, mm. I think so, yeah. Mm.
Wow.
So the next chapter then is real life death.
Yeah. This is where I've sort of condensed a lot of the more graphic deaths into one chapter rather than two. Death is interspersed throughout the book because that was the nature of my career. But there was the one we've already talked about, the guy who fell off his roof. Mm. Another one was quite a bizarre 999 call where a lady phoned and said, my neighbour, I can hear EastEnders playing through the TV. This is the EastEnders and Coronation Street were both on at 7:30 on different channels. And she said she hates EastEnders. She never watches EastEnders. She always watches Coronation Street. She's a Coronation Street addict. I think something's happened to her. And this is the most tenuous of emergencies, but the operator, fair play to her, she said, right, okay, I'm going to get police to check it out. So they sent a call to me. It was in a tower block, Shepherd's Bush Green. So I went to this flat and this lady told me the same story. And I thought, okay, it's worth investigating anyway. So I used my array of tools to get an entry to this flat. And there was this poor lady. She was sat on the sofa, head down on her chin. She's well dead, you know, proper dead. And EastEnders was on the TV, you know, with I think it was a time when Den and Angie were having a big bust up.
Oh, yeah.
So there was no, it was a natural causes, sudden death. There was no time to forced entry. There was no injuries on her. So it was what it was, one of those sad things that happens. So I contacted her son who lived the other side of London. He was making his way up. And then all this start to finish had taken 20 minutes so far. And I thought, well, there's 10 minutes of Coronation Street left. So the sofa was about the size of the one that you two are sitting on. So I switched the TV onto Coronation Street and I sat next to her for 10 minutes and watched Coronation Street.
How long had she been dead for?
Less than a day.
Less than a day.
Yeah, she had a bit of rigor mortis, but no decomposition. And the lady's son turned up and I thought, I'm going to take a real risk here and tell him what I've done. I said, this is one blind. I said, I sat on the sofa for 10 minutes. I watched the end of Coronation Street with your mum and he was just bursting into tears. Aww. He's like, that's the most compassionate thing anybody could have done for my mum. So I'm like, well, wow. Least I could do.
Wow.
So these deaths you've mentioned then have been like natural causes.
Yeah.
Or accidents and stuff. What about deaths?
Murder.
You
show up
and you're suspicious?
Yeah. There's a fair selection of anyone in London gets its fair share of murders and stuff. Sometimes they're not what they seem. There's one murder, in inverted commas, where Hammersmith Hospital A&E called us and said, we've had a lady brought in with a serious stab wound to her leg. She's severed the femoral mm-hmm. artery, and she's passed away. She's only in her early 20s. So they gave us the address. We raced around to this address on a local estate. I already had the scenario running in my head that we're going to break into this place. We're going to find a jealous boyfriend, husband, whatever, disarm him, arrest him, call down the murder squad. And that's how it's going to pan out. No, that wasn't how it panned out at all. We went to this address, which was unoccupied. Everything appeared normal until we went into the bedroom when there was lots of blood everywhere, broken glass, telephone hanging off the hook. There was makeup, hairspray, false nails all spread out. And what actually solved the case was listening to the tape of a 999 call this woman had made. And basically, she'd been getting ready for a night out with her friends, tripped up and fallen face first into this mirror, and it shattered. A piece of glass had gone into her leg.
Oh.
She'd managed to call 999 for an ambulance before she'd passed out through loss of blood. And then subsequently, the post-mortem, which was done, recovered the piece of glass, which was over 30 centimetres long, and it ended up in her stomach. It
gone
in through her leg, through her pelvis, up into her stomach.
Oh.
So everything's not as it seems. That was a bona fide murder that completely wasn't.
No.
Wow.
That sounds like a rubbish night out.
What about one where there was a murder?
Yeah, I'll have to. Most of my deaths were suicidal natural causes. There was one where I think it was a murder, and I still do, which was in Shepherd's Bush Market on one night shift. It was a Sunday night, last of seven nights. I've been walking in the rain for every night that week. I was looking forward to having some time off. At the time, there was a high-profile murder inquiry running, a guy called Christoph Schliack, who was a German barrister who'd been found stabbed 22 times in his flat just opposite the police station. A few months in, progress was very slow. This was the Met, murder teams were throwing everything at this to try and solve it, getting nowhere. So most officers were being seconded to this, so we just almost like had a skeleton staff doing the day-to-day stuff. So I was on my own foot patrol, Shepherd's Bush Market, 4 o'clock in the morning, and I saw a pool of blood with a drag mark leading away from it. So I followed the drag mark with my torch, and underneath a market stall was a body of a vagrant, the back of his head all stove in, clearly dead. He was on his back, his eyes were wide open, had the makings of rigor mortis. So I called an ambulance, because we have to call an ambulance because we're not allowed to assume somebody's dead. Called the CID down to the scene, and they sort of turned up a little bit disinterested. And I explained what I had, everything. I'd sealed off the market, blah, blah, blah. Handed it over to them and then went home 2 hours later. Came back to work the following Thursday, 4 days later, to see what progress had been made, and it had been written off as an accidental death. And then the detective said he fell over, banged his head, and that's that. I said, yeah, his body had been moved, he'd been dragged. And he's like, look, we're really tied up with this Christoph Schliack murder. We've got no resources. That's just the way it is. So this guy, Michael Merriman was his name. I think he went off to a pauper's cremation funded by the local authority, unmourned and apparently unmissed.
How sad.
So that was, that was what it was, sign of the times. But there was definitely something not right about that. Didn't add up.
You've got the case of the Faircloughs in the book.
Yeah, that was one of the most tragic things I ever dealt with, I think, in my 30 years. That was a fairly standard neighbour call saying, I'm worried about... You get fairly standard calls from neighbours saying, I'm worried about the person, singular, who lives next door. I've not seen him for a long time. There's a lot of post building up. There's a funny smell.
This podcast is sponsored by Harry's. Harry's is way more than a super sharp razor company. They're here to revamp your whole routine, from close shaves and flake-free hair, all the way to clear, healthy skin. Harry's helps guys feel great. For this sponsorship, Harry's is offering a free travel-sized shower gel with a trial set to you, the viewers, to give you a chance to try their other products as well as shave. Please make sure to support this podcast and give your own shower shave a go by redeeming a free Harry's trial set. All you cover is £3.95 for delivery. Just head to harrys.com/Sean, S-H-A-U-N, to have your set delivered and start a shave plan. Your freebie will be added at checkout. That's harrys.com/Sean, S-H-A-U-N. Thank you for supporting Harry's. Link is in the description box below this video.
You know what sort of thing? This was the first time I'd heard somebody say, I'm really worried about the couple that lives next door. I've not seen either of them for several days. The post is building up. There's a funny smell, blah, blah, blah. So I went round there, had a look. Curtains are closed. Opened the letterbox, and the smell of decomposition that came through the letterbox thought, okay, yeah, I know what's happening in here. So I opened the door with my trusty toolkit again, started searching the house, went into the front bedroom and found this couple locked in an embrace, rotting away, covered in maggots. So quickly opened the window to ventilate the place. Just about to call for a coroner, and I saw a little movement of a hand. And I thought, this is from the lady. The lady's hand moved. And I thought, Christ, she's alive. And so I quickly called an ambulance on the radio. So I need an ambulance urgently to this address. And sort of leaned over, brushed all these maggots off her face.
Oh.
And she's like, I couldn't leave him. And what happened was they'd been married for 60-odd years, gone to bed. He'd died in his sleep. She'd woke up in the morning. He was dead in bed next to her. And she'd just had a bit of a meltdown, a breakdown, and she'd gathered him up in her arms and held him for 4 days and nights, unable to do anything else, while he just rotted away.
If you died right now, I wouldn't do that.
So we got between myself and two paramedics, we managed to prise her away from the remains of her husband, get her off to ambulance, off to hospital. And she passed away the following day, unfortunately.
No.
Yeah, which was the cause of death was severe dehydration. But as I said in the book, I think it was a broken heart.
Broken heart, they say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
That was. She spent her last days just watching her husband of 60-odd years just rot away.
That is terrible. Yeah. Terrible.
So the next chapter then is...
Oh, 1 minute. I've got...
Integrity.
You're sprawling over your skinny bed while half watching EastEnders, and you thought about the horrific scene you'd witnessed in Jill's garden.
That was the false teeth. So the one that became the false teeth story. Yeah. That was the guy, Norman, falling off the roof.
Ah, brilliant.
So, integrity.
Integrity.
Yeah, that's the bit about the burglary in the flat, the fake burglary.
Oh, that's right. That one.
That's that one. There's probably other stuff in there as well.
That overlaps with Think Like a Criminal.
Yeah.
The Don Monkey Business.
Never start a fight.
You can't possibly win.
Yeah, that was sage advice given at training school during self-defense classes. Never start a fight. You can't possibly win, which served me well most of the time when I paid attention to it. The time when it came back, well, it didn't come back to bite me, but when I should have used it was the machete incident. I did the wrong thing there. Should have backed off. There's similar sort of situations further down the book where I'm following armed criminals when I shouldn't. And I think afterwards, what the hell was I doing? You know.
Yes.
Do you want to give us one of those stories now? When following armed criminals, you shouldn't.
Sure. Yeah. It starts off with until about 1994, police officers didn't routinely wear bulletproof vests. And then in 1994, I was called in to see the borough commander at Hammersmith Police Station. So always when you get that message, you wonder what you've done wrong. And he said, the Met have decided to issue every officer with personal issue body armour. We've been asked to supply across the Met 50 officers of unusual shapes and sizes for the trial. So I thought of you. I'm like, oh, thank you, sir. Yeah, I know I'm built like a racing snake, but, you know. So I took part in the trial over 10 weeks. We were given 10 sets of body armour. We had to write to wear operationally. Some of them were absolutely ludicrous. Some of them were over 2 inches thick. There was one where I could barely drive a police car because my arms were being forced so far apart. So at the end of the 10 weeks, we submitted a report, and the end result of the product, which is called the Met Vest, was, in my opinion, light years ahead of anything we tested. It was very wearable, easy to keep clean. I'm in a minority on this. I used to suffer from bad backs, and the Met Vest cured it by being like a brace for me. So I wore it religiously every day on duty. As the part of the input, we had an input from Firearms Department who was saying that bullet travels at 1,200 feet per second. I know that a lot of officers keep body armor in the boot of the car and they put it on when there's a necessity. Can you really be faster than 1,200 feet per second? And also he said, be realistic about its capabilities. Imagine if you will, a 6-inch thick block of wood like a railway sleeper and a 6-inch nail and a sledgehammer. And I give you one blow to get that nail through the wood. Imagine how hard that blow would have to be. Now imagine that same blow hitting you in the chest, body armor or not. That's the force of a shotgun blast. That would break all your ribs. You'd probably die from internal bleeding. All the metals will do will stop projectiles going into your body. So don't think of it as some kind of Superman force field. It's not. So it's quite a sobering lesson, the one that I kept up here all the time. And I wore it, I say, religiously every day on duty throughout my career, except one. On this particular day, I was not supposed to be on duty. I was supposed to be on the day off, but I got called to court in Harrow, which I thought, great, because you get, back then you get called to court, even if you're only there 5 minutes, you get 6 hours pay at double time. So it's a good earner. So I went to court, I was there about an hour, and then I went back to into the control room at Harrow Police Station just to sign the overtime state, at which point the phones and the radio just erupted with emergencies of a double shooting in somewhere else on the ground, Edgware or Wealdstone or somewhere. And everybody's dispatched to this scene of somebody being shot and possibly killed, somebody else had been seriously wounded, and it was all mayhem, as it often is when there's an emergency. So I, still with the double-time, overtime meter clicking in my head, said to the inspector, oh, do you want me to stay on? He said, yeah, get up to the scene. So I went to the scene, did a bit of crowd control, blah, blah, blah. Wearing my court uniform, I should say, tunic, whistle chain, no body armour. And then I wasn't needed at the scene, so I said to the inspector, do you want me to stay on the rest of the shift, help out a bit? And he's like, yeah, there's a backlog of calls. So I took a police car out and started dealing with burglaries and shoplifters and run-of-the-mill stuff. And 6 hours later, my heart starts thumping in my chest, and I called the control room and said, can you repeat the registration number of that car involved in the double shooting? And they told me what it was, and I'm like, okay, I'm sat behind it in Eastcote Lane, heading towards Uxbridge. Can you get me armed response? And so they started getting armed response coming towards me, which comes from central London, so there's a bit of travelling time. So I'm in a marked police car. There's no way they could have not seen me in the mirror. Following this Ford Focus, I think it was, I can see the silhouettes. There's three people in it. And I'm following this car, thinking, I have a two-year-old son at home. What the hell am I doing? And I kept following. And I had this mental picture of my Met Vest body armour hanging up at home in the laundry where I'd just take it home to wash because I'm a few days off. And I followed this car for a couple of miles, and every time we stopped, I'm thinking I should really break off from here. But I didn't. I stuck with it, and then after about a couple of miles, this two armed response car screamed past me and blocked it in and dragged them out at gunpoint. Two men and a woman were in the car. Cuffed them up, and it was they searched the car. They recovered this sawn-off shotgun from the car. And that was all that. And I went home at the end of the shift, and I thought, I've made about 300 quid in overtime today. Was it worth it? No. So that was starting a fight I couldn't possibly win. Basically, I should. It was a good result, but it definitely wasn't worth the risks.
No,
not at all.
No. So you've got a funny story to do with Paul Daniels.
Yeah. This was I was in my first year of service, and I was on a foot patrol in Shepherd's Bush. Obviously, has Wood Lane, which has the BBC TV centre and blah blah. And the call was about quite late into the evenings, either end of a late shift or start of a night shift. A call was received from a motorist from a Mr. Daniels who's locked his keys in his car at the BBC TV centre. I didn't put two and two together, but the control room knew that I carry various gadgets for breaking into cars and houses. So they sent me. So I went to the BBC car park in Wood Lane, and there was Paul Daniels, the magician, with his wife and a few friends. And I said, this is a wind-up. You, Britain's most famous magician, can't magic your keys out your car. And he's like, I really can't. So I had to sort of tinker away with the car. It was a nice, shiny new Volkswagen, I think, as I recall. After about 10 minutes, I managed to get the door open, and those keys were on the passenger seat where they'd fallen out of his pocket or something. He was like really very, very polite and gracious about it. And he said, how do you do that? So I couldn't resist the temptation. I said, well, that's magic, you know. And that was that. And they went their merry way, and I got to write about it 30 years later.
He didn't have it on his show the next week.
I never used to watch him, to be honest with you.
Same, yeah. Same.
Good cops, bad cops, and fingertip searches.
What is a fingertip search? I can imagine what it is.
This story has been heavily anonymised because of there's various, well, lots of various legal reasons to do that. But this was about a large fight on the White City estate, which was a regular occurrence, gangs fighting off, you know, fighting each other for turf control, etc. I wasn't involved in it. I was dealing with a burglary, I think, somewhere else. But what happened is two gangs had been fighting, and this guy had lost a body part, which I've called a finger in there, but that's for legal reasons. And he was lying in the other way, clutching his hand, clutching the blood spurting out of this stump. He was a very, very well-known gangster. He had lots of convictions, including attempted murder. He tried to shoot previous gang members. He had rival gang members. He had convictions for assaulting police officers. Nasty piece of work. He was taken to hospital where the doctor said, if we can find the finger within the hour, we can reattach it. So the inspector in charge, aware of possible community tensions and a big criticism if we didn't deal with this, round up every available officer, including me, to go and do a fingertip search of the streets to try and find this severed finger. And after about an hour, we couldn't find it. There was rats around, there was foxes around, there was stray cats, there was anything could have taken this finger. So that was that. It was never recovered. And it was only many, many years later when I was talking to somebody else who was involved in the search, and this story came up, and I said, yeah, so I wonder what happened to it. And this guy looked at me. He was a dog handler. He said, my dog found it within 30 seconds. He said, I made sure it went straight down the nearest drain. There was no way he was getting it back, not with his rap sheet. I'm like, okay. Wow. you can keep that one.
So next chapter we have is Dead Endings.
Yeah, you have to remind what the chapter's about. the titles were created by the ghostwriter, and
the market gloomy and deserted at 4 a.m.
That's Michael Merriman. Yeah, that's the body with the head injury.
And then we are on to quite a long chapter. Good old Bob.
Yeah, Bob Daniels was my mentor, my early years in the police. He was, he joined the force 2 years before I was born. He was very, very enthusiastic about frontline policing, even though he had well over 20 years service. And he was a extremely good advanced driver. And I used to, we worked quite well as a team. I think I was in my 20s, he was in his 40s. We would chase cars, which was his job, and then the cars would crash and the driver would run away, which was my job. I would chase after them. We're chasing a stolen Ford Escort one night around Shepherd's Bush. And he was acing the driving, you know, and I was in the passenger seat like a coiled spring ready to jump out and chase this joyrider on foot. Eventually the car did crash. The joyrider jumped out and he jumped over some spike railings into the upper Latimer playing fields, school playing fields. So Bob shouts, go get him, Matt, which was, he's done his job. He's chased the car that crashed. So I went racing after this guy. I jumped over the spike railings, totally. He was over, the suspect, the joyrider, he was over it like an Olympic hurdler. I was much less elegant, and I caught my foot on the spike railing, which ripped the shoe straight off my foot. I hit the ground, dropped my torch, smashed the bulb, and this particular torch, called a maglite, carries a spare bulb in the battery compartment. So I managed to get rid of the broken glass, get rid of the broken bulb, change the bulb, and put it back together and turn the torch back on, all while sprinting across the playing field with one shoe off. Eventually caught this guy at the far side of the playing fields, managed to arrest him and assist him back over the railings to where Bob was waiting to handcuff him. And then, well, I'd also managed to lose my handcuffs, my notebook, my radio, everything had gone flying off, and searched the playing fields. Couldn't find anything except my shoe. The shoe was still on top of the railings with a spike straight through the sole and straight through the laces. Barely a mark on my foot. I don't know how I got away with it. But the next day, everything that I'd lost had been handed in to the police station. The school staff or the school pupils had found police radio, police notebook, handcuffs, everything on the playing field, and handed them all back in. So apart from making a right mess of the climbing over the railings and wrecking a pair of shoes, I kind of got away unscathed, and we caught a joyrider. And then there's other scrapes where involving Bob, and another car chase where a car was dumped on the White City estate, or was it, no, the Becklow Gardens estate, with two joyriders in it. They both ran in different directions, so we both chased after one each. I caught mine quite quickly. Bob was gone, so I handcuffed this prisoner, brought him back to the police car, put him in the back seat, and sat in next to him. So we're sat in the back of the police car, the blue lights are still on, the engine's still running, the crashed joyriders in front of us, and Bob is nowhere to be seen. So I sat there waiting. And then a local sort of ne'er-do-well starts walking up to the police car, having a look around. I'm still sat in the back with this prisoner in handcuffs. And then this other youth, he jumps into the front of the police car and sticks the gear selector into reverse, trying to steal the police car. What? Completely oblivious to the fact there's a policeman and a prisoner in the back seat. So I lashed out at my foot, kicked the gear selector back into park, so it jolts us all backwards as the wheels lock. This guy shouted, "Oh, fuck." Jumped out, tried to run away, but he was going nowhere. I was on him. And threw him in the back seat, uncuffed the prisoner who was laughing his head off, and cuffed the two of them together. And that was one arrested for stealing a car, one arrested for stealing a police car. And then Bob came back, empty-handed, out of breath, having lost the driver. And he looked, he saw two arrests in the back seat, and he's like, "Yes." I'm like, "No." "Take the keys with you next time, will you?" Because he thought I'd caught them both, you know.
What would possess someone to steal a police car? It's like a no-win situation, yeah. Isn't it?
Never going to end well, is it, really? No. He'd not exercised due diligence. He'd seen this police car with the blue light on, the engine running, no policeman anywhere nearby. I mean, it was night time. He'd not thought to look in the back seat. Thought he'd try his luck.
So by this point in your story, then, you'd exercised CPR on a few people. What were the CPR situations?
None of them worked, oh, I should say. The one that springs to mind was in King Street in Hammersmith. I don't know how chronologically this works. But this was, I was responding to a pub fight. Going down King Street, I think it was a Friday rush hour. It's busy, the blue lights and sirens are on, carving through the traffic. The pub fight was in Chiswick High Road, which is a continuation of King Street. So I'm going down King Street, screaming past the newsagents, an off-licence, where unbeknown to me, there was an armed robbery in progress. Didn't know about it because we hadn't had a call. Got a few hundred metres further on, and the Scotland Yard called me up, say, "Diverting you back to King Street, there's been an armed robbery and a shooting." So I did a screaming U-turn back up King Street, and we were on scene in 2 minutes. And this guy, lying on the floor, this guy called Nath Bander, clutching his stomach, and he'd been shot point blank range with a sawn off shotgun. So we did CPR on him. I was doing chest compressions while my colleague was doing mouth to mouth. We're calling for an ambulance. The shopkeeper is panicking. He's saying this guy just heard the sirens and pulled the trigger. Turns out he'd heard me screaming past, thinking I was coming for him. He panicked and pulled the trigger. I wasn't coming for him. I was going to a different call. So we did CPR on this guy, and then the paramedics turned up and took over. Then he put me in the ambulance, and we escorted them to Charing Cross Hospital, but the guy was dead, unfortunately. As the trauma consultant said he had about 20 pellets gone into him. Blood was lost very quickly. It turns out the guy committing the robbery was a 16-year-old crack addict who demanded money. All this, all he got from the robbery was 26 pence. That was the proceeds. He was caught, and he was caught after his dad made him give himself up. His dad was an actor from the Bill. He gave himself up. When he was interviewed, he said, he heard my sirens, thought I was coming for him. He got 12 years in jail, reduced to 9 for good behaviour, I think. And the guy, Nath Banda, is a barrister's clerk, just popped into the off-licence for a few bits and bobs, ended up getting shot dead.
What a waste of a life.
Mm. So that was a failed CPR attempt. Another one, which was, again, it's... not sure where it sits chronologically, but when I was doing my first tour of duty with a special constable who I've called Hazel, it was her first tour of duty, and I thought, God, I don't want to take a special out there. Specials are, there's three types of special constables. Special constables, they're volunteers. They don't get paid. They get training. They get a uniform and radio and everything, and they work generally 16 to 20 hours a month volunteering. They got full police powers. And for all intents and purposes, they are fully warranted police officers. But they fall into three categories. There's those who are a joy to work with because they want to join the regulars. They're really enthusiastic and driven. Fortunately, Hazel was in that category. Second category are those who tend to be a bit older, who just want to give something back to the community and on a voluntary basis. And the third category, sadly, are those who are bullies, and they think, I can get paid to throw my weight around in pub fights, or not get paid, but have legal authority to do it. So, Hazel's very first tour of duty, we set off from Harrow and just after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I was trying to sort of get a measure for what kind of day am I going to have. I mean, it's quite clear quite early on we were going to have a good day. She was very enthusiastic, very personable. So we're chatting away, and she suddenly thrust her hand across my face, said, "Look, there's a body," pointing to the pavement. So, and there was this lady face down on the pavement. The crowd gathering around, I sort of pulled over, and this lady who was in her 80s, she'd had a massive heart attack on her feet and had face planted the pavement, her nose flattened into her face. We tried CPR on her. Well, I tried CPR on my own on her because Hazel wasn't first aid trained, so she couldn't help me. But that was another one. Yeah, that came down to public perception. There was people standing around watching, and I absolutely knew this woman was dead beyond saving. But you can't be seen to do that. You have to be seen to do CPR until the ambulance turns up, and then it's over to them.
Mm. Wow. Very sad. So maybe a nice lighter one now.
Please, yes.
You've got a funny story about a stripper, or you being a stripper.
Yes. I was always wanted to drive police cars. I was desperate to drive police cars, but my first 2.5 years, I wasn't allowed to. I was to walk a beat. But I also really wanted to get stuck into emergencies. I liked the adrenaline, the big emergencies. And often I would hear emergency calls come out, but they were a few miles away. I thought, I want to get stuck into that. But even if I was to jog there, it'd still be, the dust would have settled. It might be too late. So I thought, well, I'll start commandeering lifts, members of the public. What's the worst that can happen? They can always say no. So I started, if an emergency call came out, I'd just jump in the road with my torch, or if necessary, flag a car down. And normally these people would be horrified, like, what have I done? And when I say absolutely nothing, I just wonder if you'd give me a lift, they're delighted, usually. I think most people have this public-spirited sense. And it worked really well. I got, I would ask for a lift, then they say, absolutely, get in, and they'd take me where I wanted to go. And one of the first times I did this was on a Friday or a Saturday night, and the first car that came along was a stretch limo. Flagged it down and said to the driver, I need to get to a road traffic accident. It's about a mile away. Any chance of a lift? And this driver's like, oh yeah, plenty of room in the back. I fell for it, didn't I? This limo's got blacked out windows. I knew I got to deal what's going on. So I opened the back door. There was a hen party inside. So I thought, okay, I'll wait for the next car to come along. But no, the bride-to-be was having none of it. She just grabbed hold of me, pulled me into this limo. And the door shut and the driver drove off to where I'd asked him to go. And then 5-minute drive of some things like, you know, show us your truncheon and, you know. I was 22 years old at the time, you know, and I was, you know, this, you know, any other circumstances, you know, I'd have given my right arm for this, you know, but.
Did you have a truncheon with you?
I did, yeah, and I did show it them, yeah.
Did you have to dance for them?
Fortunately not, no. But, yeah, we got to the scene of this crash, and before I could get out the limo, some of the hens had to get out first. So these hens tumble out. They're all tipsy on Prosecco and everything. And I got out, and so I had to, you know, straighten up my tunic and my tie and put my helmet back on and everything. And these two drivers involved in this fairly minor crash, which stood there looking at me, and I had to tell them, I'm not the hen party stripper. Okay, I'm a police officer. I think I had to show my warrant card. And they were very good-humoured about it, fortunately, but starting from a position of very low credibility and authority, I had to really build myself back up to deal with this crash. And then the next time I tried to flag a lift, I thought, I'm not picking a limo. So I picked, I think it was a Ford Fiesta or a Mini. And the lady driving it was in her mid-80s, and she was absolutely terrified. What have I done? I'm saying, nothing at all. So there's a bit of a disturbance going on at this pub on Shepherd's Bush Green. I'm a bit of a way away. I wonder if you wouldn't mind just give me a lift a bit closer. And she's like, oh, of course, officer. You know, whatever I can do to help. So I got in the car. I reached for my seatbelt, and I was suddenly flattened against the seat as she wheel spun away. The pub was a mile away, and she did it in less than a minute in central London. And she went through three red lights. And I'm like, on the dashboard, and she's like, I've always wanted to do this. Screeched to a halt at this pub fight. And I got out. There was other police cars. There was a riot van there, and there was lots of blue lights. Probably about 10 police cars, police vehicles at least. Went into this pub, which was it was dealt with fairly quickly, as they often are. 3 or 4 people got arrested for being drunk and disorderly. The pub was dispersed. The police vehicles drifted away. I came out of the pub, and she was still sat there in the Mini. Where next? Thank you very much for your public spirited service, but you can continue the rest of your evening.
That'll teach you to hitchhike.
It will, yeah.
What happened when the cyclist undertook the loaded lorry?
Yeah, that was pretty tragic as well. That was a nice, bright weekday morning. I was Shepherd's Bush Green, which is, this happened near the TV centre in Wood Lane, BBC TV centre. I was driving around Shepherd's Bush Green, which is about a mile away, and a call came into a road traffic collision between a skip lorry, and a cyclist. It's become increasingly common in London, a large vehicle turning left and a cyclist going up the inside. I've been to more of those now than I care to remember. So I turned up. I was first on the scene because I was close by, and the lorry's still at a 45-degree angle into the junction, not completed its turn. And behind the lorry, there was tie marks, skid marks, alternating rubber, and what was quite clearly human flesh.
Here's a message from our sponsor. So, Jen, have you ever signed up for a gym or something or other, and then they just keep taking this money out of your bank?
Yes, it's really, really frustrating. You know, if you want to cancel, you want to cancel straight away.
Do you know why free trials renew without your consent? It's something that drives me mad.
Absolutely mental.
Of course, it's a business scam out to get you. Don't let greedy corporations pocket your money. Download Truebill to take care of your subscriptions. Truebill is the new app that helps you identify and stop paying for subscriptions
that you don't need, want, or simply forget about. On average, people save up to $720 a year with Truebill,
which is approximately 500 quid. Because these damn companies make it hard to cancel your subscriptions, Truebill makes it incredibly easy to cancel. Just link your accounts and Truebill will make it easy to cancel your subscriptions in one tap.
And your Truebill concierge is there for when you want to cancel any unwanted subscriptions.
So you don't have to.
Stay on top of your spending with Truebill. Get an effortless breakdown of your finances to see where your money is going and how to improve. Truebill will notify you of important events that need your attention so you're never caught off guard again. Like Jennifer B, who says, with your help, our family has saved $587 this year on unnecessary subscriptions. I really didn't understand how Truebill could help me until we decided to save for a very large home purchase. So don't fall for subscription scams.
Start cancelling today at truebill.com/Sean.
S-H-A-U-N. So go right now to truebill.com/Sean.
It could save you thousands per year. Thank you for supporting our sponsors. It's very important for the podcast production. And the links, as usual, are in the description box below this video.
So I've called for more. I need more units. I need traffic patrol. I need fire brigade for screens. I need this. It's what I call conflicting priorities, because you have a list of tasks. They all need to be done first. And it's an impossible situation, you know, so you just do your best. But the overriding priority is to save a life, if you can. Didn't think that was quite likely from what I could see from the back of the lorry. So I went around the side and looked underneath, and there was this scene from a horror movie. There's a cyclist, only in his 20s, face down on the road under the lorry with no pelvis, no legs, nothing, just gone from the waist down. So just from about the belt, below the belt, there was nothing. It was just shredded. He'd been, the marks, the tire marks would indicate he'd been round the axle at least four times.
Oh my God.
So I'm under the lorry, which doesn't have much headroom, obviously, crawling around by this cyclist looking to hopefully find a wallet or some ID or something. And then he lifts his head up.
No!
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
As he lifts his head up, I smack my head on the underside of the lorry because I was so startled. He looked at me and he said, "My arm's hurting. Can you move my arm?" And his left arm, I think, had a graze down it where he'd hit the tarmac. And it was touching the tarmac. So I said, I was completely in shock. I said, "Okay, so I'm repositioning his left arm." So it wasn't, the graze wasn't touching the tarmac. And I said, "Is that better?" He said, "Yes, thanks." And then died.
Oh, and my God. That.
Jesus Christ.
And I was stared in the lorry for a few minutes thinking, what the hell just happened? I've just been spoken to by a body. And then I snapped back into work mode and got out from the lorry and started doing the rest of the stuff I needed to do. But the paramedic told me afterwards, he said, it's not that uncommon with a massive trauma if the brain is still emptying out almost, that this guy would possibly have grazed his arm before he did anything else. And his arm was hurting as he came off the bike.
Holy shit.
So that's one of the few times when I've gone home thinking, switch off.
Yeah. How do you even continue your day after seeing something like that, man?
The way that we normally do, I went back to the station, I changed my shirt, my trousers, because they were blood soaked, put on a new uniform, and went out, dealt with more calls. Which is what cops do. On a daily basis.
Oh, my God.
What happened when Tracy reported Rick missing to police when he'd failed up to short work?
Yeah, this emphasised my limitations with dealing with families. Tracy and Rick were a couple who lived in Goldhawk Road in Shepherd's Bush. He had some mental health and depression and anxiety problems. And he disappeared, and she was understandably worried about him. So after about 24 hours, she'd reported him missing. Some inquiries had been made, and to no avail, he'd not been found. Then a couple of days later, the Met get a phone call from Bournemouth police saying, "I think we found your missing person. He's in a hotel room in Bournemouth. He's hung himself." So they identified him. He'd basically taken himself down to Dorset, to Bournemouth, and taken his own life. So this got sent back to us, and I was sent to the flat in Shepherd's Bush to break the news. to the girlfriend, and I said, you know, give me 10 dead bodies over one death message any day, you know, because I'm not that good at dealing with families, you know. I sometimes think I don't have the patience for it. But so I went to break the news to Tracy, and she opened the doors, as these people often do when they open the door to police officers, they know. So she invited me in, and you know, I did the usual, would you like to sit down, which never works. They say, no, just tell me. And she said, it's Rick, he's dead, isn't he? And I said, I'm afraid so, yes. He's been found in a hotel room in Bournemouth, and he appears to have hung himself. And for the briefest of time, she burst into tears and then was calm and composed again, and then turned it back on me. She said, I'm so sorry for you having to come and tell me this, officer. It must be terrible for you. Can I get you a cup of tea? And I'm like, whoa, I'm supposed to be doing this. And she was, there's various ways, I'm told, various ways that grief manifests itself. And this was just indicative of her way of dealing with it.
Shock.
Shock, and to think about other people and not her own feelings. You think, right, you've had to come and tell me this. This is not fair that you should have to break this news to me with all it puts on you, you know. So can I look after you? Can I get you a cup of tea? Can I? And this was a very surreal situation for me. So I eventually had a cup of tea with her, and I think she gave me some counselling. And and yeah, it's bizarre. And then I did the usual, is there anybody I can call on your behalf, etc., make sure she's okay. Then I left thinking, what just happened there? I've just been looked after by somebody I'm supposed to be looking after. It was very strange. There's many ways this grief manifests itself. And because historically the police were terrible dealing with families, there was they started doing proper family liaison training and having family liaison officers who were properly trained in how to handle families and how to be the link between the investigation or the coroner's court and the family. I didn't do family liaison training, but I did the family liaison awareness training, which everybody had to do just to give us it's a day's course just to show us what they do. And right from the start, you could see the need for it, because the example that was given as to why do we need better interactions with families was a case in London where a teenage girl was stabbed in the street, staggered to her own front door before she collapsed. Her mum came out and cradled her in her arms as she died. Police were called. She got mum on the doorstep with blood everywhere and a dead daughter in her arms. And the first thing the police officer said to her was, what the hell are you doing? You're destroying the forensics. Get away from her.
Oh!
That's why we need the family liaison training.
Oh, my God.
Oh,
and
wow.
It all improved from there.
So we got another lighter note,
yeah,
I'm hoping.
There's not many of those.
Another limo story with Santa.
Santa, that's great. That was
two limo stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep bringing it back to the light.
You said you were going to flag any more limos now.
This was Christmas Eve, 1997, I think. Well, actually Christmas Day, because it was after midnight. I was on a night shift in Harrow, just patrolling with a guy called Pete, who was a very, very enthusiastic young probationer. This is a days before ANPR, automatic number plate reading cameras, when we had to manually have lists of number plates to look out for. And he would do this diligently. Start of every shift, he'd check the crime computers, see what stolen cars, disqualified drivers, drug runners were around. Excuse me. And he had this list on the dashboard. So we're going down this fairly rural road in Harrow called Old Reading. And a stretch limo goes past us the other way with a guy dressed as Santa Claus driving it. And I sort of pointed, look at that, there goes Santa. His sleigh must be in for a service or something. And Pete sort of banged the dashboard, said, it's stolen. That limo's on the list, it's stolen. So I did a U-turn and went screaming after Santa, put the blue lights on, and he went for it. This stolen limo went for it. He shot off and he led us on a merry chase around Harrow and Bushy, Watford, Oxy, all points in between, wrong side of the road, through red lights. We're in a 3-litre Amiga. He's in a stretch limo. He's never going to get away from us. The power difference is definitely on our side. And eventually, he went barreling into a roundabout too fast, skidded off the road into some trees, into some bushes. So I came to a halt. Pete was out the door like a whippet, flung open the driver's door of the limo, about to grab Santa, drag him out. But Santa got the engine started again and started to drive off with Pete hanging on the door. So there have been police officers have been killed in these circumstances, hanging onto speeding cars. So I thought, I knew what I was about to do, but which was illegal, but I couldn't stop myself. And I rammed it, which you are actually allowed to do now. It's called tactical contact, but it's taken a long time for those rules to change. Anyway, back then you weren't allowed to do it. So I barreled this Amiga straight into the side of the limo, pushed it back off the road into a lamppost. Driver stalled again. Pete dragged Santa out, handcuffed him, job done. And that was that. So we're left, now the dust is settling. I've got my police car embedded inside of a limo. We've got Santa in handcuffs and it's Christmas Day. And there's so many stories spring to mind about disappointed kids not getting their presents and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, Santa was carted off to the cells. And then the following day, Boxing Day, he was taken to before the magistrates, still dressed as Santa Claus, and then remanded in custody to Wormwood Scrubs prison, still dressed as Santa Claus. And I'd just love to be in a fly on the wall when he turned up at prison. Merry Christmas, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that was, it turned out he was interviewed. He said he's a well-known prolific car thief, and he'd had this idea that he broke into a showroom of prestige cars, broke into the office, stole the keys to this limo, and he'd been driving around London all Christmas Eve touting as a minicab, a novelty minicab. And in no more than 3 or 4 hours, he'd made 400 quid. Until we put a stop to it. So it had been working, you know, it'd been working for him. So that was, that was Christmas 1997, which is hugely entertaining.
Admirable element of creativity in that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, you've got to admire his creativity, and if we hadn't caught him, he'd have made 1,000.
Yeah.
You got to admire the creativity. And he was no trouble, you know. He'd been through the mill so many times, he knew the score. He's quite happy to be arrested, and he didn't put up a fight.
You spoilt his Christmas.
Spoilt his Christmas, yeah. But made mine.
So in 1992, you got offered a place on the advanced driving course.
Yes, that was my my utopia. That's what everything had been for. I'd been serving about 6 years at this point, and I just wanted to drive the fast cars. So before you get there, you have to be a basic driver, which is untested. You basically have an assessment round the block. Then you can do your standard driving course, which entitles you to drive Astras and station van. You can respond to emergency calls, but you can't chase. And then, provided you pass those courses, you have a good driving record, good performance record, you can go for the advanced driving course, which was 6 weeks at Hendon. This is then, it's all changed now, but 6 weeks of driving high-performance cars. So Vauxhall Omegas, Vauxhall Senators, Rover 827s, at stupid speeds around the country, training in fast response and vehicle pursuit. And I got offered the place on the course, which was the like gold dust. Each police station would only get one or two places per year. So I was, you know, thrilled and honoured that it was my turn. But it didn't happen as it should. The course was supposed to be in May, and about a couple of months before the course, I made one absent-minded mistake that would pretty much ruin my life for the next year, which I forgot to take my packed lunch to work. And simple as that, I was late shift, made my packed lunch, left it on the kitchen worktop and went to work without it. The most innocuous, innocent mistake you can make. When it came to break time, about 6 o'clock that evening, went to get a packed lunch, nothing there. My colleague was going to a very well-known burger chain for his meal. I said, right, I'll join you. So I had a chicken burger and chips from this burger chain, and that was that. And then 6 hours later, woke up at home in absolute agony with stabbing pains in my stomach. To cut a long story short, I called my GP out of hours number. An on-call overnight doctor came, had a look at me. He said, you need to go to hospital now. Got me to hospital. I spent 2 weeks in isolation at Norfolk Park Hospital with severe salmonella poisoning. Lost about about half my body weight. And then it took 18 months to get all the body weight back, but it took me 4 months to recover fully from that. And during which my inspector phoned me and said, I'm taking you off the course. You're not in a fit state to do 6 weeks of high-speed driving around the country. And I tried to plead with him that I can make it, even though I knew I couldn't. And he said, no, my mind's made up. I'm taking you off the course, but I'll get you on the next one. And I said, that's bullshit. You won't. These courses are so rare. He was like, Matt, trust me. I know people. I will get you on the next course. So that was that. And he did. So instead of doing the course in May, I did it in August, I think, by which time I was nearly fully recovered, but not quite. So, and that was 6 weeks of thrashing fast cars around the country, doing mock pursuits and emergency calls, and absolutely loved it, with a few hair-raising moments, like one particularly torrential rain day. I'm on the M1 in a Vauxhall Senator doing 110 miles an hour with the instructor, a very grumpy sergeant, sat next to me and two other students in the back seat, and I started to aquaplane. Now, with 110 miles an hour and you're suddenly going sideways instead of forwards because you've got a wedge of water under the tyres. So I instantly dropped the speed and the instructor's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm aquaplaning. And he's like, all right, okay. Waited 5-10 seconds. Have you got the grip back yet? I'm like, yeah, I think so. I think we're good. He's like, well, what the fuck are you waiting for? Get that speed back up. So, and off we went again, 110 in the torrential rain. But apart from that, and the only other sort of mishap was when we're having an end of day debrief, and he was going through my drives, and so we went through Danbury, and you stopped at a ford, you know, like a stream across the road, you know. He said, "How deep was the water?" I'm like, "It's quite shallow, 6 inches deep." He said, "Not even that, 4 inches." I'm like, "Okay, so your point is?" He said, "So why did you stop at the edge and look both ways? What do you expect, a toy canoe?" He said, it just felt like it was a road, like it was a junction. He said, "You lost vital seconds on the emergency call." I'm like, and everybody else is laughing in the classroom, you know, this is the debrief. And I thought, yeah, okay, fair point. But, you know, it just felt like I'd come to a junction. And so what I should have done was not plow through it, but no need to stop, you know, just slow down. But apart from that, I managed very, you know, no major mishaps, a few minor ones. And after 6 weeks, was awarded the coveted title of advanced driver, which was one of the main reasons I'd wanted to join in the first place.
So earlier on, you mentioned pursuing vehicles through red lights. What's the protocol when you go through a red light after a vehicle?
The protocol is you treat the red light as a stop sign. It used to be a give way. It's now a stop sign. In other words, you come to a halt. You make sure you're clear, then you go through. If, as a result, as happens regularly, people coming through the green light crash into each other, which does happen, then your actions are looked at. The black box is downloaded to see how fast you approached. And even though you've stopped at the red light and other people have crashed into each other, you could still be culpable. So you treat them extremely carefully. Fortunately, with the Santa case, he was battling through red lights and getting lucky. I was stopping at the red light, make sure it's clear, and then with a 3-litre Amiga, boom, I was on his tail again. So the car had the power to be able to afford to stop and check it was clear and then go through and still catch up.
Have you ever had anyone get away?
Yes.
I mean.
My very, very first car chase was in my first week of night shifts after qualifying. It was a quiet night, and suddenly the radio burst into life with the area car, which is the area cars are the high performance pursuit and response vehicles, which at the time was a Ford Sierra 2-litre, which was okay. You know, it was quite nice to drive. The area car, which covers Kensington, burst into life on the radio. They were chasing a van involved in a smash and grab at a jeweler's. So I piped up. Yeah, we piped up. Yeah, we'll help them. And then the third car piped up with, yeah, we'll help as well, and Matt, you stay back because you're the new boy, kind of thing. So fair enough, you know, I was relegated to third position in this pursuit because I was new. I'd never had a chase before. And I was frustrated, but accepted it. And then the chase went through Shepherd's Bush into East Acton Lane, into East Churchfield Road, where there is a level crossing, which everybody knows is not level at all. This transit van involved a smash and grab hurtled through the crossing. The first police car, which was from Kensington, tried to do the same, grounded out, ripped the sump off the engine, and died. The second police car, which was the one that told me to hang back, braked but hit the oil slick, spun out and hit a parked car. And I came to a halt without crashing. And watching this smash and grab, the lights of the van involved in the smash and grab disappearing into the distance, and thinking, it's my first chase and I'm told, know your place, but I didn't crash. And the other one that allowed to get away was I was very cross with myself because I succumbed to red mist, which is a phrase used when you are so focused on what you're doing that you ignore the dangers. Hasn't happened to me that often, but a couple of occasions when it did happen. One was pursuing a stolen moped, which had somehow managed to travel down, I think, the M4 all the way from Wales to London without crash helmets, without L plates. And none of the police forces that passed through had even noticed it. Nobody reported it, but we were chasing this moped 50 miles an hour. And I was getting drawn in, getting too close. And I remember my colleague who was sat next to me saying his exact words, for fuck's sake, Matt, you're going to kill him. And suddenly I snapped out of it and I backed off and let them escape. And I realized afterwards, I thought, what if we'd had a collision, if they'd fallen off? Falling off on a motorway without a crash helmet is never going to have a good ending. So there'd be an inquiry, which will involve our in-car video audio being seized and my colleague being heard to say, fuck's sake, Matt, you're going to kill him, and me ignoring it, my feet wouldn't touch the ground. So that was one that I allowed to get away, and I was kicking myself afterwards because I'd got drawn into red mist. And the only other time when I got drawn into red mist was chasing a stolen Porsche, which we'd chased for a long time, chasing it, losing it around Bushey, Watford, that northwest London area. And afterwards, I watched back the video. We eventually caught it. He crashed and we caught the guy. I watched back my in-car video recording and absolutely cringe. And I see myself approaching with restriction according to the speed trace, 72 miles an hour through a width restriction. And afterwards, the following day, I thought, I'm going to go and check that because that sounded a bit tight. So I went back to the same width restriction with a tape measure. And there's 3 inches either side of the wing mirrors to the steel bollards. And I'd gone through at 72 miles an hour. I thought, this has to stop. Yeah.
Harry.
What happened to the 32-year-old barrister's clerk known as Nath Banda?
He was the guy in the robbery in the off-license who was shot.
Okay. That was him. Oh, that's that,
got
that's that one.
A yes. Crash scene that led to a rapist getting caught.
Oh.
Yes, that was...
Someone done their research this morning.
Again, this story has been heavily anonymised by myself and Nicola, the ghostwriter, and then further anonymised by the lawyers because... the victim at the time was a young child. She would now be an adult, obviously, and there must never, ever be anything that can identify her. So the anonymized version is, which is factually correct, but we've changed enough facts to identification to anonymize it. A car overturned on a main road out of London, the A40. Elderly driver who was hanging upside down by seatbelt, semi-conscious. So lots of police, lots of ambulance, fire brigade, etc. I was came along on a police motorbike. All the scene stuff was being dealt with, so I volunteered to be the continuity officer, which the official role of continuity officer is you accompany a seriously injured or deceased casualty from the scene to the hospital, hand them over to a named medic, and that's so the idea is that when... if the guy dies and it goes to a post-mortem, the pathologist is doing the post-mortem on the right body. It's continuity. In reality, the role is wider than that. You're also responsible for liaising with any relatives, with identifying the person you've taken to hospital, basically anything, seizing clothing, anything that involves dealing with that person. So I accompanied this guy in the ambulance to hospital. He's starting to regain consciousness while I search his clothing to try and find his wallet identification. I found his wallet, which check for ID. So yeah, he's got his national insurance card. Okay, so we're on the right road here. And then I noticed the top of the wallet, brown leather wallet, had been sliced open with a razor and then sealed with super glue. And straight away, I thought, I've seen this before at Notting Hill Carnival. It's a way of hiding drugs. Yeah, you prize up the back, the leather part of the wallet from the liner, stuff your drugs in there, glue it shut, and then it can be easily missed in a search. So I prized it open, and this, I thought, yeah, there's something in there. It's bulky. So I tipped it out, and out fell 8 Polaroid photographs of our man raping a child. And I sort of dropped these things in horror. And, right, okay, we've got to get on this, because this is now gone from being a minor careless driving incident to something much more serious. So I showed the photographs to the consultant and said, this is a child, isn't it? And the consultant was like, definitely that 10-year-old, maybe even 8. I subsequently found out I was possibly breaking the law doing that, because showing photographs of that nature to anybody is very strictly controlled. Anyway, that's another story. So I called the Child Protection Unit at the Met at Scotland Yard. They sent 2 detectives down. The driver turned out to have very minor injuries, just a bit of whiplash, bumped on the head. He was arrested on suspicion of possession of child pornography and of rape.
Was he the person in the photo?
Mm-hmm. Yes. He'd in at least 2 of the photographs, the photos were taken in a mirror with his face visible.
And was it a female child or a male child?
Female child.
It's disgusting.
Yeah. So the detectives did an absolutely splendid job. They could have charged the guy with possession of the photographs and be done with it. But clearly the priority was to identify the girl. So they did about a 3-week investigation to trace this girl. She was eventually found many miles from London in a county. The offence had happened 4 years earlier when she'd been 8. She was now 12. And meanwhile, they'd had a specialist search team search this guy's flat, and they'd found in a drawer tiny slivers of paper, which went to the laboratory, and they did a mechanical fit with the photographs in the wallet. He'd trimmed the photos down to fit in his wallet, thereby establishing an evidential link between him, the wallet, and his home address and the photographs. It all tied in together. He still denied it. He still denied that he was out there anything to do with him. So roll forward about 6 months. The girl has been interviewed on video. She's given a shocking account of how this guy had raped her over a period of years. The tragically well-known tale of "It's Our Little Secret, Don't Tell Anybody."
Do you know how he came to enter her life?
I do, but I can't disclose that because that might lead to identification.
Okay. Okay.
But yeah, there is a he did. He just did. Let's leave it at that. It went to court, the Old Bailey, and the girl gave evidence via video link, and she was spectacularly good. Intimate details that a 12-year-old would not know unless it was true, you know, stuff she couldn't make up. On one day of the trial, the girl's father leapt out of the public gallery and sprinted across towards the dock to try and attack the defendant. And I had to rugby tackle him and drag him out of the court against every moral fibre in my body. Outside, he's very apologetic, and he's like, "I'm really sorry, just seeing that animal sitting there denying everything and smirking." And I'm like, "Well, I understand." I said, "I've got a young daughter myself, and I get it, I do, but I had to stop you." And he's like, I understand, I'm really sorry." End of the trial, he was unanimously found guilty of all the charges. He was jailed for a total of 32 years, but with concurrent sentences, he would actually end up serving 8. Except he wouldn't, because he died in prison 3 years later.
Was he attacked?
I hope so, but I don't know.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Mm. But afterwards, after the trial, outside the court, the girl's parents approached me. I get a bit emotional at this point.
Bless you.
Surprise.
And they said, "Thank you for giving us our daughter back."
Wow.
And that was, you know, that's made the job all worthwhile, you know.
We certainly salute you for that. What a monster.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And not previously known to any agency, no previous convictions. You don't get to the age he was at. He was in his 60s without, you know, just become a paedophile overnight. You know, so whether or not he had other victims, we never found out.
No.
What do you think possesses someone like that to take pictures? Is it like a trophy or something? Like serial killers have trophies.
Yeah. Trophy, a sexual stimulant, memorabilia.
Yeah.
Of course, his error was having his face in at least two of them. Because that made it much easier for us to prove it was him.
And he might have got away with it, but for the road traffic accident.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Fate.
I mean, we searched his car. We thought we might find a boot full of kids' toys and stuff, clothing, nothing. Nothing at all.
Nothing.
So he stayed under the radar for a long time, but he's dead now, so every cloud.
So how did it make you feel when Sergeant Michael told you that your arrest figures were too high?
Yeah. I'd always wanted to, as I said before, my ambition was to be an advanced driver. You had to get noticed for the right reasons. So I was taking every call going. I was arresting everybody I could. I was trying to get noticed for the right reasons. Some of the sort of old sweats on the team, the old sweat is a term for a senior experienced PC, very, you know, very knowledgeable. But occasionally that has negatives with it as well. They'd complained to this sergeant. He was quite a young sergeant and quite impressionable. And they said, just, you know, get Matt to wind in a bit, will you? His figures are comparing badly, unfavourably with ours. At this point, the sergeant or any supervisor has two choices. He can say, well, up your game a bit, or he can do what, and you roll over and tell me to wind in a bit. So he chose the easier option to tell me to not to be so enthusiastic, not to be so proactive, because of the contrast between me and some of the others was embarrassing for them.
Did you?
No. I applied for a transfer instead. I'd been at the Shepherd's Bush 9 years at this point. I thought, yeah, it's time to move on. And fittingly, at the top of the charts at the time was Stay Another Day by E17 and Think Twice by Celine Dion.
Love that one.
Yeah. So I thought twice, but I won't stay another day. So I moved on and started 5 years at Harrow. So I was probably stagnating a bit by this point after 9 years at one point, but that was the final straw for me to tell that I'm working too hard and too enthusiastic. Okay, it's time to go.
Yeah.
So, Matt, what happened to Kieran?
Kieran was another example of me reluctantly having to deal with a bereaved family. He was at an all-night party in Harrow at a flat. There was all sorts of alcohol and drugs and substances at the party. When they'd woken up in a haze on the Sunday morning, this guy Kieran was clearly deceased behind the sofa, obviously overdosed on something. So police were called, ambulance was called, and I went to deal with this as a drugs death. It struck a chord with me a bit because I got his details and he was born the same day as me. He had the same date of birth, so he was 34 years old, I think. So dealt with the scene. Got the body shipped off to undertakers, to the mortuary. And then it was my job to go and tell his parents, who lived a few miles away also in Harrow. A job I hate doing, as I've said, you know. So I knocked at the door, and this lady answered the door, a little bit frosty, being disturbed on a Sunday morning by a police officer. And I said, you know, can I come in? I've got some news for you. And she's like, no, if you've got something to tell me, just tell me now here on the doorstep. So I thought, okay, well, I have no choice then, you know. So I said to her, well, I'm afraid it's your son, Kieran. He's been at a party last night and I'm afraid he's passed away and he's been taken to Norfolk Park Mortuary. And without even breaking a sweat, she said, drugs, was it? And I'm like, well, there were some substances knocking around, so possibly yes. And she said, well, it's sad, I suppose, but boys will be boys. Thank you, officer.
Oh, my God.
And shut the door.
Probably a shock reaction.
Yeah. And I'm left there outside the house thinking, did that just happen? You know, and they've just told her son is dead. I mean, presumably there was some kind of frosty relationship with her son, but not the reaction I was expecting. No, and to tell her that son, who was same age as me, had just died. And she was like, oh, well,
Boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys, yeah.
Well.
What happened when, at 3 a.m, a call came in, a 23-year-old lad in a VW Golf had hurtled into a roundabout at high speed.
This was a top end of Harrow, obviously on the night shift at 3 a.m. And I was second on scene, the first officer on scene, my colleague, who'd got there and he was dealing with the accident, and I pulled up and said, right, what do you want me to do? And he was clearly very shocked, this officer. He's a 20-something veteran, very hardened to it all, but he was clearly shocked. I said, what's up? Is it fatal? He's like, no, it's not fatal. It's much worse. So, and I could hear screaming coming from the car, from this Volkswagen that had crashed into the pedestrian railings. So I'm like, okay, go on then. What's happened? And basically what had happened is this Volkswagen is way too fast into the roundabout, gone off the far side, into the pedestrian railings, and the railings had somersaulted through the windscreen of the car and then gone out in through the bottom of the driver's seat via the driver's genitals.
Oh!
He was pinned to the seat by a 2-inch-wide metal spike, basically. So I was quite happy to say, I'll stay here and direct the traffic then. I'll shut the road. The fire brigade cut the railings. They can't take it out. Obviously, they cut the railings at both ends, cut the seat out. They managed to get this lad out, get him to the ambulance with about a foot-long metal spike still piercing his genitals. And I was like, yeah, give me a fatal any day rather than, you know, my eyes still water thinking about it.
Do you know what happened to him?
He survived. Whether or not he went on to have children, I don't know. But I imagine it would have needed quite a bit of reconstruction from what I gather. So this railing was 2 inches wide and it had gone straight through and was pinning him to the seat.
Mm.
When you say straight through, you're talking the ball sack?
Yeah, and his penis as well, yeah. Straight through.
Wow. Men's eyes are watering everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, and rightly
yeah.
so.
Yeah. Wow.
So the next thing then is the jury protection.
Yes.
Yes, that was in the mid-90s. After, I think, 10 or 11 years doing frontline response, I fancied a bit of a change when this opportunity came along. There was a very large corruption trial underway at the Old Bailey with a number of defendants with sufficient gangland connections to be a serious threat. So the judge had declared that every member of the jury would have 24/7 police protection. Which is quite a big operation that needs 6 police officers for every juror. So 72 officers, 6 for each of the 12. And our brief was to stick with this juror 24/7 for the whole 6 weeks of the trial, working in shifts, doing 12-hour shifts. So we'd have the 6 officers for each juror. 2 would be guarding her day shift, 2 would be night shift, and 2 would be on a day off, and you'd rotate. The only time we would not stick to the juror was when they were actually in court. Then we would have some downtime. But at night, we would park outside the house and keep an eye out and do short foot patrols around the house, look for anybody lurking. And during the day, when they weren't in court, we'd follow them wherever they needed to go. And we did that for 6 weeks over Christmas. The trial started at late December, mid-December, and went on until January.
Was there any attempts from the gang members?
Not for our juror, no. There was a couple of suspicious incidents where we figured we'd probably been filmed by the press because the fact the jury were under protection was common knowledge. The juror's location was a closely guarded secret, obviously, for that, but the press are quite resourceful. And we figured a couple of times these press might be trying to get pictures of officers asleep on duty, you know, because obviously sitting outside somebody's house for 12 hours overnight is quite a demand on your eyelids trying to stay awake. But there was no, as far as I'm aware, there was no threats, no overt or covert threats to any juror. So the system must have worked.
Wow. You then worked undercover, and you've got a story to do with Edgar Pierce.
Edgar Pierce, yeah. 68-year-old, known notoriously as the Mardi Gras bomber.
Ooh.
He had a real problem initially with Barclays Bank and then subsequently Sainsbury's, and he started creating and planting bombs, homemade bombs, which left several exploded. At least one person was very seriously injured. A few others got minor injuries. So the Met launched Operation Heath to throw massive resources at this problem, to try and catch this guy. And our job was to stake out Sainsbury's in Harrow for several weeks over the winter of whatever year it was, I forget the year, late 90s. And we worked in three teams. One team was in a derelict flat overlooking Sainsbury's, looking for suspicious people. We had very little to go on. We knew it was a white male, and he's probably in his 60s. That was all we knew. If we saw somebody that looked suspicious, we would radio the follow team outside. They would follow the guy away from the store, then stop and search him. And the third team were working undercover in the store as Sainsbury's staff and customers. So I did my first 4 weeks, I think, in the observation point, which was quite hard. It was a sub-zero temperatures. There was no heating or anything, this flat. And it was long days looking out the window, looking for people who looked like they might be the bomber. It was very demanding, boring. But when we rotated into the work in the store, that was much more entertaining. I was a shopper, so I used to walk around the store with a basket, picking up only cans and dried stuff. You can't pick up fresh stuff because it has to be disposed of. Walk around looking for the bomber. And I had a full basket. I would dump it out the back so a member of staff could restock the shelves, and I'd pick up another basket. My colleague on the team, he was a staff member. He was posing undercover as an assistant manager. He had the Sainsbury's uniform and everything. Wow. And he was 100% into his role. He was, I would turn a corner as a shopper into an aisle and bump into him. He was actually briefing a new member of staff about product placement and how this works. And bear in mind, this is an undercover police officer doing this, pretending to be a store manager. And The operation started and finished without us catching the bomber, sadly. He got caught elsewhere. But it was very frustrating to work in the store. We were told at the briefing that you will see stuff going on in a supermarket. You'll see shoplifting. You'll see pickpocketing. You might even see robbery. You have to ignore it. You're looking for a terrorist. So stay focused. And that's easier said than done, because I saw several examples of blatant shoplifting. I saw a purse being stolen.
Oh, no.
And it's really hard. Your every instinct is just to drop the basket and intervene, and you can't. So our operation ended. We were stood down after about 6 weeks or 8 weeks. But then a few weeks later, my colleague, Liam, I think his pseudonym is, was contacted by Sainsbury's saying, do you want the job? Assistant manager, you did so well at it.
No way.
And they knew he was an undercover cop, but they said, you've absolutely blown this away. And if you want the job for real, leave the police and come and work for us. It's yours. And he was very flat. He declined. But he got to keep as a memento. He got the Sainsbury's assistant manager badge. He got to keep that.
Did the other staff members know that he was undercover, or did they keep that under wraps?
I think the management knew. I'm not sure how much they'd pass the information around. There was the risk of a leak to this guy was considered quite low, because he was known to be a loner. He's not part of some big criminal network. But I think the actual intelligence about who was doing what and why was kept as under wraps as was necessary at the time.
Ah. Well, when the Ford Focus fled the scene of a fatal shooting?
Yeah, that was the one with where I wasn't wearing my body armour when I'd been at court.
Oh, gosh, okay. Yeah.
These have probably possibly skipped out of chronological order, unfortunately.
All right.
What is a white knuckle car chase?
White knuckle is a phrase from theme parks that, you know, if you're on one of these really fast rides, you're gripping so tight that your knuckles go white.
Ah.
That's all that means.
Oh, right.
So what about this killer then of the kid, the runner over, was it?
Yeah, Kurunathan Ananthakumar. Took me a while to learn that. That was, that started Christmas Day. I don't know what it is with me and Christmas days, but things seem to happen. In 2003, and I was off duty, rare Christmas Day off. I got a phone call on my mobile from a colleague who was at the scene of this crash in Southall. He said, there's a six-year-old child been run over. Doesn't look like she's going to make it. Can't get hold of the on-call sergeant. Do you have his number, etc.? So I helped this guy out. I said, do you want me to come in? He's like, no, I don't need you today. You can enjoy Christmas Day, but you can pick it up tomorrow. So at the time, my kids were, I think, 10 and 6, I think, or... No, it must have been younger than that. They were eight and four, they were. So I was watching them sort of playing around, larking around with each other and thinking, you know, there's a six-year-old just being possibly killed in an accident. How would I feel, you know? And so enjoyed the rest of Christmas Day. Then Boxing Day, I went in and picked up the investigation and became engrossed immediately. The guy had been driving down a bus lane in Southall, Broadway. Southall's a predominantly Sikh, Hindu and Muslim area, so even though it's Christmas Day, a majority of shops were open. So this this young girl, six-year-old Fatima, had been out with her mum to a shop, and as they're crossing back over the road, she'd run on ahead of mum across the bus lane where there shouldn't have been any traffic, and this car came to the inside and hit her. Knocked her down. She'd gone over the bonnet, and then this guy had driven off. And then 40 minutes later, he'd phoned 999 and reported his car stolen, which is a very common tactic. People do this when they've been involved in a hit-and-run accident or a traffic offence. They'll phone 999, report it stolen, and then be like, oh, couldn't possibly have me driving, officer. My car was stolen, you know. And it's it happens with quite a lot of frequency. So I set about... getting the evidence that would prove who the driver was. I suspected it was this guy, Ananth Kumar, who was the owner. I suspected it was him, but I had to prove it. And as the investigation unfolded over the next weeks and months, I became increasingly frustrated because I'd come up with a dozen ways I could prove he was lying, but I couldn't prove he was driving. And there's a big difference. For example, when I interviewed him, he told us that he'd... there's photographs in the middle of the book that show him in a shop. He'd said that that's where he was when he phoned 999 to report his car stolen. Mm. We got the mobile phone analysis from his provider, who put him at least 6 miles away. So we knew he was lying, but it didn't prove he was driving. The breakthrough came when I was working late one night, and I was using this very new bit of technology called Excel, which is now very common, obviously. I'd received Ananth Kumar's phone records from his service provider, and I put them in an Excel spreadsheet, and I was just playing around with filters and sorting and everything, and just basically getting to grips with how this thing worked, sorting it to various columns and orders and chronological things. And it was when I was looked down the date and the time of phone calls that were made from his mobile phone that I thought, well, according to this, he made a phone call at 4 a.m. on Boxing Day. Now, I knew that can't be right because he was in custody. We'd arrested him Christmas Day evening, and he was in custody overnight, so that can't be right. So I dug out his custody record, and I checked. Actually, he was released at 3:53 a.m. So, all right. So he's been released at 3:53 a.m., and 7 minutes later, he's made a phone call. Right, we're getting somewhere now. Who's he phoned at 4 a.m? I've got a number. Who is it? I'll send it off for a subscriber check, but before I do that, I'll check my case notes and just see if I already know the number, which is a real long shot. And lo and behold, the number popped up as belonging to an independent witness, a passing van driver. So I stopped to take stock and I thought, okay, this guy's been arrested. He's been released at 4 a.m. on Boxing Day, and he's phoned an independent witness, somebody who should be a complete stranger to him. This guy who's been allegedly passing van driver. So I thought, let's pay this van driver a bit of a visit. So I went and... knocked on his door at 6 o'clock the following morning, and on the doorstep arrested him for perverting the course of justice. And he burst into tears straight away and said, no, don't arrest me, please. Oh. And he confessed all. He hadn't been a passing van driver. He'd been in the passenger seat of the car. Ananth Kumar was driving, and they concocted the story between them. We've run over this little girl. Let's keep quiet about it. So I said to this guy, this witness, I said, you got two choices. I said, you can stick to your story and go to prison for perverting the course of justice, or you can give me a statement, you can agree to be a witness, and get on with your life. Your call. There's no honour amongst thieves. He chose the second option, obviously, without hesitating. Mm. So he went to trial. I got authority to charge this guy with Ananth Kumar with causing death by dangerous driving. This was after, just to rewind a bit, the Crown Prosecution Service initially said no. Okay, yeah, we accept he was in the bus lane. He was driving too quick at the bus lane. It's not really enough for dangerous driving. It's more like driving without due care, which would have necessitated, would have ended up with him getting a fine, maybe a short driving ban for taking a girl's life. It's not going to happen. So back to the drawing board, we need to prove his driving generally was bad. So I started trawling through cameras, bus lane cameras, everything, and I found footage. Again, I've put the photo in the book of him driving through the bus lane, ploughing into a puddle, spraying pedestrians with water, 300 metres before the accident. And the bus lane was, you shouldn't have been in the bus lane. It's a 24/7 bus lane, including bank holidays. So I went back to the CPS and said, I've got the pattern of bad driving, 300 metres beforehand. He's splashing pedestrians. He's driving at the bus lane. And they said, okay, well, you can charge him with causing death by dangerous driving, but you won't get a conviction. And I thought, yeah, we'll see. So we went to Isleworth Crown Court. I had two hurdles to overcome. I had to prove he was driving. And if I did that, I had to prove he was driving badly. Because he could say, okay, I was driving, but it was the girl's fault. So the first hurdle was overcome when we started doing the identification evidence. He'd been picked out in identification parade by a number of witnesses. And his defense to that was, these people are all mistaken, but they picked me out because they all don't know somebody who looks like me. And I thought, this is ludicrous. And his barrister at this point thought, this is ludicrous. Let's have a short adjournment. So we got an adjournment, came back into court, and the barrister said he's now prepared to accept he was driving at the time of the accident, but maintains there was nothing wrong with his driving. It was the girl's fault. So I was big hurdle overcome, but we still got to prove it was his fault. So we did this with the defence tried to undermine everything possible. My star witness was 14 years old. She was an absolute superstar. Amanpreet was her name. She's entitled, as that age, she's entitled to give evidence from behind the screen. Defence barrister objected to this, which he has no right to do. It's an absolute right. So the judge got quite shirty with him. They called a collision investigator, an independent one, to say that the report says she went over the bonnet. Children are too small. They don't go over the bonnet. They never go over the bonnet. They go under the car.
Mm.
And as an expert, the golden rule of an expert witness is you should never say never and never say always, because it only takes one example to shoot you down. Our barrister promptly provided several examples of children being hit by a car and going over the bonnet. So he was discredited. They called a consultant trauma surgeon who said, the judge sensed a rat here. He said, I'll speak to the surgeon in the absence of the jury. And this surgeon had more letters after his name than I've got in mine. You know, he could tell you black is white and the jury would believe him. And he confidently said that in his opinion, this car was doing no more than 20 miles an hour. So we'd estimated it was more like 40. So it couldn't have been dangerous. So the judge was like, what training have you had in vehicle dynamics? What training have you had in accident reconstruction? How many child victims of fatal accidents have you dealt with? How many times have you been to a crash scene? Blah, blah, blah. And you just crumbled. You had no training in dynamics, no training in reconstruction, never been to a crash scene, probably dealt with half a dozen child victims. So the judge was like, you're not coming in front of the jury. You're not getting that. So he went away with his tail between his legs. And the final tactic the defense tried, because they were trying everything to keep this guy out of prison, was to undermine me. I'd hit a technical problem with the footage from the bus lane, which is, so the still is in the book. The bus company supplied it on a DVD. The Crown Court had VHS video players. Now, it's very quick to transfer VHS to DVD. Easy, technically very easy. DVD to VHS is a nightmare. And our video lab had said it'll take them 6 weeks to do. So I thought, okay, I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to do this. So I took the DVD evidence home with me, played it on my DVD player, on my TV, set up my camcorder on a tripod, filmed the screen, which was recorded to VHS, and copied that, took it to court to produce that as the evidence on the VHS tape. that the jury could see. So far, so good, but somehow the defence got wind of this and said, this evidence was on a DVD. Can I just, how come it's now on a VHS tape? So I thought, I was in the witness box at this point, under oath. Well, the lab said it would take 6 to 8 weeks, so I took it home, I played it on my TV, and I filmed it with a camcorder. And the defence was, you know, this is a clear breach of protocol, Your Honour. Can I ask this be excluded? This evidence be excluded? And the judge said, nope. We're going to show it. So, oh, thank God for that. Yeah. So that was that. And eventually, yeah, the evidence all complete. The jury retired and very quickly came back in with unanimous guilty on every count, which was causing death by dangerous driving, failing to stop after a collision, fraud, because he'd filed an insurance claim, a false insurance claim for theft of his car. Even when this all was all unravelling around his ears, he still tried to maintain the deception. He was jailed for 3 years for the death, a further 9 months for the fraud. Personally, I think he got off lightly. Mm-hmm. The harsh truth was the girl was a bit culpable in running across the road, which is why the sentence was a bit weak. The judge has to take these things into account. But outside the court, the girl's parents, Maku and Abakar, I think, were just delighted from a position of being fairly hostile towards the Met, because, you know, they were asylum seekers. They'd been through a lot. They had felt it was almost a stigma. They thought they wouldn't get justice, that we would just write them off, which was never going to happen. There was hugs and tears all around, and thank you for getting justice. And that was another.
So you say you got 12 years?
No, you've got 3 years and 9 months.
Oh, 3 years and 9 months. Yeah. What, do you have to do half of that?
He did have to do half, I would think. Yeah, he was again, no previous convictions. Like the rapist, he was not in the system. No, nothing.
I've got a few questions on this one then. So, in the beginning of the story, you said that your colleague told you will never get a conviction.
The Crown Prosecution Service said that, yeah.
Why did they say that?
There are some CPS lawyers who like easy options. They like to get a high conviction rate, and they would know that if we charge this guy with careless driving, his lawyer might say, plead guilty. You're getting off lightly. If we charge him with causing death by dangerous driving, we would have a much more of an uphill struggle and less certainty of a conviction. I pushed and pushed and pushed for the higher charge, because I cannot watch this guy walk away from killing a six-year-old with a fine. It wouldn't happen. So there were some Crown prosecutors are historically reluctant to go for higher charges. For that reason, they like to get their hit rate, their conviction rate high.
You got an award for this, didn't you?
Yeah. There's an award called the Livia Award, which is... it was set up in honour of Livia Galli Atkinson, who was a schoolgirl who was killed in a hit and run in North London, Enfield, I think. Her parents, George and Giulietta, set up the award, which is presented annually at the Houses of Parliament to an officer who's excelled in the field of road death and traffic related stuff. I was nominated, made the shortlist, got interviewed at the House of Commons, and then got the award in 2004. So
my next question is to do with the speed limit then. So he tried to say he was going 25, did you say?
He 20 or under, yeah.
20 or under,
yeah.
In a bus lane.
Yeah.
So if you are driving illegally in a bus lane and you're going 20 or under, what's the difference if you're in there and it's illegal to be in there in the first place? Is that what the speed limit is on that road?
It's the speed limit's 30.
30.
There was two lanes. The lane one is the bus lane. The lane two was solid traffic. It was heavy traffic.
You see that?
Yeah. So he's scooted up the inside to avoid the traffic. Yeah. But they're separate matters. The fact he was in the bus lane is evidence of his just illegal driving, because he shouldn't have been there. The speed is if he'd been doing 20, he would have had a chance to see Fatima and to brake. And if he had hit her at 20, she'd have probably had survivable injuries. So part of our evidence was the fact he was in the bus lane. That's a given. That's one part of the offence. But the fact that he was doing the speed he was doing, which our collision investigator estimated as 30 to 40, up the inside of stationary traffic in the dark and the wet, was all part and parcel of being dangerous, basically. Yes.
Did he give an explanation of why he was in the bus lane? Or was it just to try and save time?
He didn't. He didn't give an explanation. He every interview I did with him, and I did about four interviews before he was charged, he was just sticking to this story, which was drove to the shop in Hayes to do some shopping, parked outside, did my shopping, came out. My car wasn't where I parked it, so I walked 300 metres left, 300 metres right in case I'd forgotten where I parked it. It wasn't there. So I caught a bus home. I phoned 999 to report it stolen and caught a bus home. And that was that was basically all he ever told me. It was at no point until halfway through the trial did he even accept he was driving.
Did he have a family of his own?
Yeah, he had a wife. I think he had kids, but I'm not entirely sure.
So when he when he was confronted with the reality of the situation then, was his claim that she just walked into the in front of the car and it was her fault? Is that what he was trying to say?
In court, yes, when he changed his story and accepted he was driving, he was basically saying it was entirely her fault for running straight across in front of him.
Sounds like an arsehole.
When you told a passenger that you will go to jail for this, can the passenger be held liable for the illegal activity of the driver if this happens?
No, not for the driving, no, but for perverting the course of justice by giving us a false statement, which is which carries up to 7 years in jail by saying that he was a passing van driver, giving us this pony story that he was going the other way. He just saw the accident, and a vague description of the driver is all perverting the course of justice.
So it's his responsibility to report that right away. Mm-hmm. Is that
yeah? His responsibility to tell the truth, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha.
But we agreed. But I agreed with the CPS that if he now retracts that statement and becomes my key prosecution witness, would you agree not to charge him with anything? And the CPS would. Quite happy to do that.
Of course. Okay, so I'm looking at some of your dashing photos, and you had a a domestic incident involving a shower screen.
Yeah, that was in Hayes. Went to call to a domestic between a husband and wife. What I'd call, sadly, a fairly standard thing. You know, lots of argy-bargy between husband and wife, rowing. And I was working with a female officer. I think I've called Jenny, I'm not sure.
Hey.
And we attended the scene, and as standard practice, you separate them, you speak with one each. So she was dealing with the wife in one room, and it's a small flat, so there's a golden rule with domestics is that you shouldn't speak with people in the master bedroom because it's too much of an intimate space, and you shouldn't speak with them in the kitchen because there's too many weapons. So I was left with just with the small bathroom. So I said to the guy, we'll speak in there. So I was chatting to him. He was quite a big bloke, quite drunk and quite agitated, very fired up. So I'm trying to calm him down and say, well, how are we going to resolve this? You know, neighbours have called. They can hear the fisticuffs, the screaming, the banging around. And then my radio sparked into life with my colleague in the other room who said the phrase, Sarge, he's got to come in, which is, means he's got to be arrested. Unfortunately, he heard this before I had a chance to do anything. We just ended up in a one-on-one fist fight. Tumbled backwards into the through the shower, into the bath. There's a shower over the bath, tiled wall, and he's sort of throwing punch after punch, trying to connect. And then he grabbed my hair and ran my face straight into the tiled wall, which is why in the photos I've got a split cheek.
Yeah,
it's only lasted about. The 20, 30 seconds it took for a colleague to come to my assistance. Then we managed to get him down and overpower him with the wife standing in the living room screaming hysterically. But he was charged. He went to court and he got he pleaded guilty and he had to pay me £500 compensation. So, every cloud again.
Every cloud. But that's not the only injury you've sustained, is it?
No, it's not, no.
This one here cuts up your arms. What was that one?
Yeah, that was I caught a burglar red-handed. I chased him across a few gardens until he was cornered, and then we ended up in a one-on-one fight, and he had really, really sharp fingernails, and that's That's why my arms and my face look like they do in those photos.
It looks like you've been attacked by a cat.
It does, yeah. And that's, yeah. That's how it felt.
Yeah.
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 That's exactly how it felt, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So in late January 2000, you were driving home after a night shift listening to Heart FM when a terrifying road rage episode exploded around you.
Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, you're in a bit of a daze normally coming off nights, you know, because all you want to do is get to bed. So it was a Sunday morning, as I recall. The A40 was pretty much empty. So I'm driving along, just cleared a junction in the middle lane, and then I'm in lane one. A Rover came past me in lane two, and then a tow truck came past him in lane three. So, and then at this point, I see nothing to attract my attention, and then suddenly the tow truck suddenly swerved to the left, deliberately rammed the Rover, sending it spinning 360, 720 degrees in a shower of broken glass and plastic. As I'm swerving around it, trying to avoid being part of the accident, the Rover is now wrecked on my left, and the tow truck is on my right, speeding away while the driver puts a balaclava on. Now, you won't be surprised to hear that this triggered me thinking something's not right. Yeah. So I got my phone, 999, said I'm an off-duty officer following this vehicle involved in it. Guys have got balaclava, and he's just rammed another car. Timing was bad because it was shift change over time, so there was a lot of police cars and police officers were at the police stations having briefings. There was nobody out on patrol. So I followed this tow truck for a couple of miles. It comes off the A40 at the target roundabout through several red lights with me following, again, trying to not to crash. And at this point, I notice there's a yellow Fiat Punto behind me also doing three red lights. So I was too focused on my 999 call in the car. I didn't give that a second thought at the moment. Anyway, this guy shot off and I carried on chasing him. Looked at my mirror, the Punto was falling behind. It was somewhere else, so didn't give it a second thought. The tow truck crashed. The guy jumped out and ran off. I chased after him across a kid's playground. Caught up with him. I dropped my mobile phone into the grass. And fortunately, it stayed connected to Scotland Yard. And this guy was a very stocky, muscular guy who didn't want to be arrested. So, and he managed to land a good few punches on me. And I'm shouting into my phone, "Where's that backup? I need backup now." And the guy, the operator, shouting, "We're trying to dig him out to try to get him to you, try to get police cars to come to me." And then I looked across the grass and I saw the silhouette of the yellow Punto and two people bailing out and running towards me. And I thought, that's it, I'm screwed. That's this guy, somehow this tow truck driver has got his back up before me. Fortunately, I was mistaken. This was a really nice couple on their way to work, seen the crash, same as me, and they'd also decided to help out. So I'm rolling around, this guy's throwing punches at me, and I shouted at these two, "I'm police officer." And the guy, who I've called Michael, just leapt straight in and piled into this bloke with me, and we managed to pin him down. While the girl, who I've called Gemma, she was on the phone to Scotland Yard saying, "We got this off-duty police officer, we're trying to help out, this is where we are, blah, blah, blah." And after a few minutes, police car turns up. So I'm just shouting, "Handcuffs, have them handcuffs." They run across the grass, give me the cuffs, and we lock this guy up and put him to his feet. And this guy's sweating and he's snarling and swearing and spitting. And he looks at this point, the girl, who's only a youngster, Gemma, she bursts into tears because of the shock of it all. And he looks her straight in the eye and he sort of says, "I'll remember your face, you fucking bitch." And she stops crying, looks him right in the eye, and then boots him in the balls so hard.
Yes,
literally lifts him off the ground. I mean, me and this other police officer were holding an arm each and he's lifted off the ground. So we dropped him into the grass and he's screaming his head off. "Like, did you fucking see that?" Right. See what?
Nothing.
So, so he went off to, he got locked up for dangerous driving. There's a few other offences. He had no licence, bits and pieces. Officers went back to the A40 to try and find this smashed up Rover. Nothing. He'd obviously got something to hide as well, so because he cleared off. We never found out what it was all about. It might have been a drugs-related thing.
I mean, how common is it for people to follow you with your blues and twos on? You know, when they do it naughtily, though.
Yeah, it's quite common with motorbikes. If you're driving a police car cutting through the traffic, you will quite often get dispatch riders and pizza delivery riders forming a snake behind you because you're cutting a line through the traffic.
Yeah.
Deliveroo.
Yeah. Although it happened to me once the other way around. I was on a police motorbike cutting through lanes 2 and 3 of heavy traffic. I looked in my mirror and there was a car following me, making a fourth lane. So I sort of stopped and sort of told him a few facts of life, and he was just a chance of trying to make progress through the rush hour traffic in his Ford Escort.
Is there a legal term for it?
Tailgating.
Tailgating.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh wow.
So you actually worked a 56-hour shift?
Yes. That was.
That sounds like something you make me do.
That was partly greed and partly stupidity on my part. I was a collision investigator, so my job was full-time working out of the office, investigating fatal and life-threatening, life-changing road collisions. And my supervisor, Mick Cheeseman, said to me one day, do you want to do double shift? I got no late shift cover. I was on the early shift, which was 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. for these 2 days. He said, do you want to do double shift? Do late shift as well. So 16-hour shift. And in my head, that meant work 16 hours, go home for 8, work 16 hours, and then job done. I can do that. So I said yes. It was coming up to Christmas. Overtime would be very handy. And afterwards, some guy in the office said, you're an idiot. Well, why is that? He said, have you forgotten that late shift also covers on-call overnight? He said, it's Tuesday morning. He said, you might not be in bed till Thursday afternoon. And I'm like, externally, I said, yeah, well, I can handle it. And internally, I'm going, why didn't I think of that? And that is how it panned out. It was call after call after call. From the first night, I worked from the late shift, worked through the night at a fatal accident where a guy had been decapitated.
What?
How?
It was a bad combination of a young man, alcohol, and a powerful BMW. He'd floored this BMW as a 4-litre Alpina or something, fishtailed the car, rear-wheel drive, so the back end started twitching, and he'd flipped it over.
Ooh.
He hadn't been wearing a seatbelt. He had his window open, and as he's overturned past a tree, the tree has taken his head clean off. He had passengers in who were all wearing seatbelts. They all survived with minor injuries.
Wow.
But that was... That took me till 4:30 in the morning to finish, and then just time to go home, change my shirt, and back to work for 6 a.m. And then the second night, I finished on time, about 10 o'clock at night. I literally walked in my door, and I got called out to a bin lorry that had crashed into a house somewhere in North London. Two occupants at the back of the house, very, very shocked but uninjured. So I went rushing down to the scene, and there's a fully laden bin lorry had misjudged a keep left bollard, gone ploughed off the road through the front garden and smashed into the front of this very large detached Georgian house. And what followed then was a comedy of errors, because I called at the control room. I said, I need two things. I need a heavy duty recovery and I need the borough surveyor, because this house is unsafe now. They both turn up together, and I just watched like a tennis match, these two batting off each other. The borough surveyor saying, right, pull the lorry out, then we'll get some scaffolding in. And the recovery driver saying, if I pull the lorry out, the house might fall down. You need to put the scaffolding in around it first, then I'll pull the lorry out. And the borough surveyor was basically like, look, my party, my call, get the damn lorry out, and we can get the scaffolding up, we can all go home. So the recovery driver was like, your call. So he pulled the bin lorry out, and the house fell down.
Oh.
Subsequently, this is, I know I've gone off a bit of a tangent with a 56-hour shift, but so the house fell down, and it was a few weeks later. I was doing a follow-up inquiry from the local authorities. They wanted to speak to the surveyor, and the answer was, he no longer works for us. He's currently negotiating with the lawyers whose fault that was.
Big lawsuit,
yeah,
there.
Yeah, for a big house. So that was the... So yes, I was called out from home, spent all night at that one, and then the same again, just back home in time to change a shirt and back to work again on the Thursday. And then I managed to bimble through, and in between all this was when we came across this suicidal woman on the motorway who tried to climb electricity pylon. That was again related to going to make non-urgent inquiries, driving up the motorway, the M1, to see a couple of witnesses to a different accident. I wasn't driving. I was so tired. I got somebody else to drive me. I've been awake 40, 48 hours at this point. And the control room calls up and say, just to let you know that Hertfordshire Police responding to a female apparently standing on the motorway with her arms crossed across her chest. Now, this straight away triggered alarm bells ringing because that's a suicide pose. Yeah. And almost as we got the call, we're like, ah, there she is. So we pulled up behind her, frantically calling for everybody to shut the motorway because if she was to dart into traffic, it'd be game over. She's dropped her hands away from her chest. We were behind her at this point, dropped her hands down, and her right hand is a big knife, and her left hand is blood pumping out of her wrist. So it's getting a lot more tricky here. I'm trying to, and again, I have put a photo in the book, a couple of photos in the book from this. Yeah. I'm trying to be close enough to basically run her over if she starts to run into traffic, being the lesser of two evils, without being so close that I spook her, make her do something stupid. Anyway, after a while, she exited the motorway across the barrier and climbed the grass embankment towards a 500,000-volt electricity pylon. And this was time to act, so we jump out of the car. She started to climb the pylon. And I'm frantically grabbing for my CS gas, my baton, my cuffs, whatever I can do. And this is going to go horrible. In the end, I just shouted at her, "Get down! Now!" And against my expectation, she did. She got off the pylon into the grass, and I said, "Drop the knife." And she did. "Oh, this is going well." I said, "Have you got any more weapons on you?" She's like, "Yeah, I've got a knife in my back pocket." Okay. So at this point, my colleagues circle around the back of her, and he managed to grab her wrists, and we handcuff her, get both the knives. And fortunately, the control room had already requested an ambulance, which we'd completely forgotten to do. So we took her back down to the hard shoulder. The motorway was completely deserted at this point. It had been closed at both ends, and it was quite eerie. Ambulance came through. We put her in the ambulance, and she was ferried off to get the mental health support that she needed and get her wrist patched up. That was a case of, where were we? Witnesses. Yeah, we were on our way to see some witnesses, and then back to the job. And then 2 o'clock Thursday, the shift ended, 56 hours.
Do you think because it was non-stop action, it helped you actually? Mm-hmm. Because if you would have fallen asleep at the desk otherwise.
Totally, yeah. Non-stop action, caffeine and Red Bull.
I was going to say caffeine and Red Bull.
Yeah, coffee
and Red Bull. Wow. Preparing for tragedy. Anathakuma case.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the case.
Oh, okay. That's the hit and run, yeah.
And the Livia, what's the name? Arena promotion. Okay. So, let's see where we are then.
Yep. Wow. What is a Met Office police party like? A Christmas do? I've always wanted to know. No.
I think they can vary enormously. They're normally quite good natured because we have a duty to behave in a certain way on and off duty. There are obvious exceptions. There was one in the press recently about some off duty officer headbutting a member of bar staff who complained he was breaching COVID regulations. So there are those who let the side down. The one I've written about in particular, I think...
It's in here, is it?
There is one in there, yeah. Okay. Where our sergeant at Harrow had been arrested for curb crawling on duty. We were on a late shift, 6 p.m. to 2 a.m. He'd paraded us all at 6 p.m., given us our postings, then he disappeared. We didn't know what happened to him. It turned out he'd gotten his own car, driven to King's Cross and picked up a prostitute right under the watchful eye of Operation Welling, which is an anti-drugs and vice operation in that area. He was chased. He was caught in uniform with a prostitute in his car. He was suspended. I was given 2 stripes and told I was in charge of the team. And then a few months later, at the Christmas party, we were having a really good time at a pub in Pinner, and he walked in the same day that he'd had his misconduct board. And he got himself a pint. He was already drunk. And he sat down at the table in the stunned silence, and he said, "I've just lost my job today. Merry fucking Christmas, everyone." And at that point, everyone, me included, just started making their excuses and left, decided that the night was over. But Christmas parties, generally, they're good. They're not as bad as some office parties where you have less of a legal responsibility to behave.
What happened with Sarah, the 14-year-old shoplifter of Wicked Blue?
WKD Blue.
WKD Blue.
Is it Wicked? Is that what it stands for?
I think it is Wicked. Okay. Yeah. It is, isn't it, guys?
Yeah, I believe so. I was newly promoted. I finished the Anantha Kumar accident investigation was pretty much my swan song at accident investigation. I was promoted and transferred out back to the front line. Started with 6 months doing as a permanent custody officer at Uxbridge. And one of my first customers was this young lady, 14 years old, who'd been arrested for shoplifting. She'd been knocking back some WKD Blue. So at that age, I have to call a parent to the police station. So I called Mum, and me naively thinking that it would be a great shock for Mum, because I was actually new enough then to see the best in people. Mum turned up, and I said, really sorry, I'm this might be a shock for you, but she's been arrested for, and I was cut off by Mum slamming a hand on the counter saying, "You do know she's pregnant, don't you?" And I said, "I didn't. All I know is she's 14 years old, she's bunking off school, she's getting drunk and robbing shops." And Mum was like, "Well, if you harm her or that baby, I'll have your fucking jobs." And it's a threat we hear many times, but anyway, any sympathy for Mum went out the window. Mum was like, "How long is this going to take? I'm on a night out tonight."
To drink WKD Blue.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Anyway, and in the end, I finished with Mum. I was going to get rid of her, and Mum said, "And you make sure you give her these," and put a pack of 20 cigarettes on the desk. I thought, is any more confirmation of the bleak future this girl faces? Mm. That was it. Oh. So that was, my first experience of the sort of the dysfunctional families that... this was kind of Mum's only concern. Wasn't concerned about her age and bunking off school, robbing shops. Just the fact that the baby was at risk, and of course it was our fault somehow.
Baby's at risk if she smokes those fags.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely ridiculous.
The next step then was coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
How do you?
Which is that? Was that start off with? That's the chapter.
Found out Laura's cancer.
Yeah, Laura's my wife. Nice. She'd the previous chapter, I'd just done my mass fatality training, which was fantastic course. I really enjoyed it. And then this chapter is that my wife had been diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and she'd been given a 80% chance of recovery. But it didn't happen. And then on my 43rd birthday, she was at the hospital having some treatment. We had a little birthday party for me in the room, which her colleagues had thrown, which was very nice. And the consultant came in and said, "Can I have the room, please?" So these friends all left, just leaving me and my wife. I knew what's coming. And he said, "I'm really sorry. There's nothing more we can do. We've exhausted all the avenues." And we're like, "How long has she got?" She said, 3 months. At this point, the kids were 6 and 10, I think. So this was particularly gutting, because just a few months previously, she'd had a commendation for 20 years service to the Met without one single day sick leave. And then all of a sudden it all come at once in cancer. So I've written about this chapter to highlight the support we got from the Met, which was outstanding, from everything from my commander saying, "Do whatever shifts you want. Be off when you want, work when you want. You can use police vehicles to go and visit in hospital. Just do whatever you need." The HR manager said, "You don't live too far from me. If you need help with childcare, just give me a ring." Her friends arranged rotas for hospital visits. I believed I was superhuman. I could cope with this. I cope with everything. And I couldn't. I had a breakdown, which is, again, I've written about, which is quite hard. And having been given 3 months life expectancy, she survived just 3 weeks. Oh. And then we had, we had a forced funeral. She was with a guard of honor. All my team were in white gloves and caps, and she had a motorcycle escort. So she was given a really good funeral, recognition of her service, And then it was like, it's just me and two kids. And then, but the Met are very good at pulling out the stops when they need to, and the support I had was phenomenal, and eventually got back on my feet, basically.
My God, how old was she?
43.
43.
Yeah.
So young.
Yeah.
Oh, good grief.
Yeah, it's no age at all. And to have a 20-year commendation for no sick leave was just a real kick in the teeth.
Oh, my God.
Oh, bless her. What's it like going back to work with two young kids and a single dad?
It was still not sure entirely how it all came together to work. You know, being at the time, fortunately, my home where I lived was less than a mile from my police station, so the commute was nice and easy. I had good childminders. My commander did a welfare check on me, and he said, "You know, what you do next week?" And I said, "Well, I need to take some special leave because I'm supposed to be on early shift, but my childminder's got transport problems." He said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I want to work, climbing the walls at home." So he said, "Well, I'll send a police car for your childminder. Does that solve it?" I was like, "Yeah, that solves it." So my childminder got picked up and taken home in the police car. I got to work two shifts and protected my sanity, you know. Yeah. But it's, I felt the need to put this in, partly because it was quite cathartic for me to write, but also because there's so much negativity around the police. Mm. And they're really good at some things, and welfare is one of them.
That's good to hear. Mm. Really good.
What about the gas explosion?
Yeah, that was, again, I was, I think I was at Hayes Police Station, which is, you know, in West London. A call came into Thames Valley Police dealing with a gas explosion. I believe there's fatalities. I thought, oh, this could be interesting. They said the name of the premises, Mr. Fizz. I thought, that's opposite my house. So I went screaming down there. And the fire brigade were already there. And the ambulance crew were carrying this guy out. He had leg missing above the knee, and he was screaming. And as you can imagine, they're trying to stop the bleeding. There was another one inside who was apparently dead. The fire brigade wouldn't let me go in. It was too unsafe. So this was outside the Met just. So Thames Valley Police turned up, and I said, "Oh, I'm a Met sergeant. I'm also a local resident. So what can I do to help?" And he said, "Great, control the crowd." So it was quite surreal because I was manning this cordon of the crowds, and I knew every single one of them because they were my neighbours. So it's the easiest crowd control I've ever done. but that was that turned into a health and safety inquiry, which turned out the guy operating the it was a cylinder refilling factory. They refill cylinders for pubs and anywhere else that needs compressed gases. He'd not been trained properly. Apparently he'd misread the instructions. He'd set the pressure to 20 times the safe capacity of the cylinder, and it had literally exploded. So the firm ended up getting fined tens of thousands for health and safety breaches.
How many fatalities were there?
One fatality and one lost leg.
Christ. How do you get extremely good at planning for the last disaster?
Yeah, that was...
sorry, I've gone back a bit.
That's the mass fatality training. To go back a bit further, when 7/7 happened, the bombings, I was on holiday at the time. When I got back, obviously almost all the Met were involved in one way or another. It was a massive thing. This is where the 52 civilians and the four terrorists had been blown up on the trains, tube trains and the bus. My role as a borough response sergeant at the time restricted me to just cordon duty and secure mortuary security and really, really mundane stuff. And I wanted to get more involved. So in the aftermath of 7/7, the Met realised they were under-resourced for mass fatality. So they advertised for 10 sergeants and 50 constables to train as disaster victim recovery officers, or DVI, disaster victim identification officers. So I applied along with 2,000 other officers, and I was accepted as one of the 10 sergeants. So the idea was then we get trained in body recovery to maintain forensic integrity, dignity of the victim. We would be deployed to scenes of mass fatality to do everything from recovery of the bodies, the body parts, to the mortuary, identification, and then on to the inquest and release to the families. So the opening of the course was by the chief superintendent in charge of disaster preparedness. And that's the phrase he said, if we're very good at planning for the last disaster. In other words, we're not that good at looking forwards. You know, we planned for 7/7 after it happened. We planned for the Marchioness after it happened. So they were trying to address this shortfall and get ahead of the game by having the trained officers trained up, refreshed regularly, still in their normal day jobs, but ready to be deployed at a moment's notice. And it works, and it works really well. And the training was excellent. He came up with the phrase about, if you have feelings like this is not in my remit, or I've not had the training, or don't know how to do that, he said, there's the door. This is not for you. Everyone must be prepared to do everything. If you're deployed as the photographer and you're asked to go and pick up body parts, you go and pick up body parts. You don't say, it's not in my remit. And that was great for me, because I like all the multifaceted stuff like that. So I was I did the training, and then the advanced training, and then I was put on the call-out list, and where I sat for 10 years until 6 months before I retired, and then Tunisia happened. I was actually off duty in Birmingham with my wife. She was attending a conference, and my phone rang. Is it Sergeant Calverley? Yes. Calling from CO3 Department of Scotland Yard. You better get your kit and be prepared for deployment. So I said, what's happened? She said, sorry, I got loads of phone calls to make. It's Tunisia. Just check out Sky News. So I checked out Sky News, and it was this guy who strolled down the beach in Sousse, pulled an AK-47 out of a parasol and slaughtered 38 people, of which 30 were UK citizens. So a few days later, I got my deployment. I wasn't going to Tunisia. I was going to be the mortuary team leader at Fulham. So we had very little time to prepare before the stream of hearses started arriving from Bryce Norton. And then we, over about the next week or 10 days, we processed all 30 postmortems. And that's something that'll stay with me forever, is I've seen lots of injuries on duty, on people, fatal and non-fatal, from handguns, shotguns, knives, but until this point, never from high-velocity rifle rounds. Ooh. And I remember being in my white paper forensic suit with my mask and my gloves on, taking a deep breath and opening the first body bag as it, when it had arrived from Tunisia, and just recoiling at the sheer damage that bullet can do, single bullet can do. It was, but we got on with it, and then we paused for nationwide silence, 2 minute silence. We were actually in the middle of three post-mortems, and we just stopped everything. And that's quite surreal, thinking the whole nation has come to a halt. We got three bodies here. We got 27 in the fridge. And this is who everybody's remembering. And wow, we were here. We're here in the thick of it.
Wow.
So the high-powered weapon, it just blows holes in the body, does it?
It does, yeah. The I can't go into too much detail, but there was there's one guy who, the pathologist said if he'd survived, he would have lost his arm because of the amount of bone that had been taken out.
Wow.
So there was an incident whereby you guys spotted an old Nissan Sunny parked next to a high wire fence with two hooded men by it.
Yes, that was, I was on a supervision patrol in West Drayton with two of my colleagues, Jess and Pat. I was in the back of the BMW area car. There wasn't much happening, so we're just patrolling a few crime hotspots, and we went into this industrial estate in West Drayton, and we saw this. He said there's Nissan with two hoodie guys stood next to it. So on with the blue lights, we launch up and block them in straight away. On the other side of the fence was a silver Ford Focus, which switched its lights off and sped away, never to be seen again, or so we thought. So we stopped these two. They were two drug addicts, heroin addicts, and they were quite candid with us. They said, yeah, we were about to buy from our dealer and you've just messed it up. So we said, right, we're going to take you and the car to police station for a full strip search. And there were no trouble. So they went in the van, and it was my job to drive, because I was a third officer in the car, to drive the Nissan, their back beat up old Nissan. So I drove the Nissan back towards the police station to search it. And then a mobile phone rings. I hear the old Nokia ringtone. So I'm very careful. I put my hands, because it's a junkie's car. and I found this mobile phone under the passenger seat with a number withheld. So I thought, well, what the hell, I might as well go for it. So I answered it and put my best drug-addled voice and went, yeah.
Yeah.
And this guy on the other end, he goes, what the fuck happened there, man? I'm like, well, it was the fuzz, man. They spooked us. I'm trying to think, what would a drug addict talk like, you know? And I'm like, but we're really clucking, man, you know. And this guy on the other end of the phone's like, right, calm down, I'll sort you out. Go to the Toby Carvery in Langley. Okay, I won't let you down.
He's like, don't let me down, man.
You know, just be there. Like 10 minutes, be there. So I ended the call, raced back to the police station where Pat and Jess are just about to sort out the strip searches. I said, leave it. Get this jailer to it. We've got to go. I'll explain later. We raced out to the car, screaming off to Langley, which is about 6 miles from West Drayton. Pat cut the twos and blues as we got close, so we didn't make too much noise. And after a few minutes, we were in the car park. We're in a marked police car. It's not ideal, but we had no time to arrange anything else. A silver Ford Focus drives in and tries discreetly to leave again when he sees the police car. So we launch forward and block him in. Jess jumps out, gets the driver out. He puts his hand straight up in the air. And I didn't notice anything until he heard this metal clang. And he'd thrown away a plastic container which had hit the sign that said Toby Carvery. Landed back at its feet. So unlucky for him. So picked it up. It's full of wraps of crack and heroin.
Oh.
So he arrested him and took him back to the police station. And back at the police station, the two junkies had been searched. They had nothing on them. So they were outside waiting for the paperwork to be done. Took this guy into custody and told he'd been arrested for possession of drugs with intent to supply. And he sort of, you could see he was asking, how did you know to come and get me? So I said, give me your phone. So he gave me his phone. I did last number redial and my body armor started ringing. He's like, that was you? He said, yeah, you were talking to me. He said, you fucker. Unlucky.
Unlucky. Right. What's been your most favourite memory from the police?
I think the Santa arrest on Christmas Day. That was and looking back as well, the monkey bite. Funnily enough, it's, you know, yeah. I've tried to be in the book. I've tried to be as well as writing about my successes. I've tried to write about my failures and my shortcomings and embarrassing moments. And the monkey was an embarrassing moment, but I can laugh about it now, especially as my thumb works again. I enjoyed the camaraderie. I enjoyed working with a lot of the people and the fast driving. I love the fast driving.
They even tried to get you out of retirement.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two, 3 years after retirement, when I came back from holiday. There was a letter waiting for us from the commissioner asking, would you consider rejoining the Met and either a paid or a voluntary role? And I did give it, I'm 99% sure the answer is going to be no, but I did work out the figures and everything and the implications. You could return at your original rank, so I would return as a sergeant, but you could be posted anywhere. You could be posted to the far side of London. You would have to pause your pension, which I was already receiving. And it basically worked out. I would have a 200-mile-a-day commute for £1,000 a month. So I thought, you're not really making this attractive enough for me. So I decided to give it a miss. And I've had my 30 years and I loved every minute of it.
Well, coming up to the end of your time there, you have an incident with a guy threatening to throw himself off the M4.
Yeah, this was my second attempt to prevent a suicide. I'll come back to the first one, which is quite embarrassing, but I'm sure you want to hear about it. Mm-hmm. This was a bridge over Junction 4, I think, near Heathrow Airport. So a 15-metre drop onto tarmac. And this guy was, literally threatening to jump off the parapet onto the road down below. So we got the road closed, which saying closing a motorway in rush hour London is a really eerie silence. It's very strange. And myself and my colleague Scott we approached from different sides to this guy, and there's a huge pressure knowing that one wrong move, wrong tone of voice could make him jump. And so we're trying to get a rapport going with this guy trying to get him to safety before we start getting into the details of what's actually going on. Unfortunately, Emirates Airways came to our rescue because they landed a 380 over our heads at Heathrow, and it's just sufficient distraction for him to look up and us to grab him.
Wow.
So just a split second. So we drag him. He's only a small bloke, so we pulled him back and into the ambulance and away, and he was off to hospital again for the necessary mental health treatment. The first incident was many years before, when a young girl was standing on a window ledge, threatening to jump. And so I went up into the room, first floor room, to speak to her while my colleague waited downstairs on the pavement to try and keep crowds away. And I was talking to her through this window. She's 14 years old and she was high on something, as well as alcohol. Her mum, who was in the building, was totally disinterested. What is it with 14-year-olds and their mums? I don't know. Mm. So I was talking to her, trying to get a rapport going through this window, this open window. And it wasn't going very well. And then her eyes shut and she started to sway. And I thought she's going to pass out. So I thought it's now or never. So I made a grab for her. But all I did was push her off. I misjudged it. So she fell down to the pavement. And I just heard this sickening thud. She hit the pavement. My colleague, who was holding back the crowds, it's like, stand back, I'm a first aider. And he went straight away to try and give her mouth to mouth. You know, she woke up and punched him in the face. Because all she actually had was a sprained ankle.
No just, way.
So, yeah. So it was...
Holy shit. So lucky.
So she was, again, she was trussed up and put in an ambulance to take her off to the hospital. I went back in to speak to mum and I said, look, she's jumped off the ledge, but it's only the first floor. She seems to be okay, a bit of problem with her ankle. So hopefully we'll get her the treatment she needed. And... you know, and she'll hopefully that'll be fine. And mum's response was, did you shut that window? Bloody draft blowing through here. I'm on the sick, you know. So I didn't know, and I don't care personally, you know.
Oh, boy.
So that was my first attempt at suicide prevention. So on the M4, 20 odd years later, I feel I redeemed myself a little bit.
Most definitely.
Wow. So on the news all the time, we see like knife crime and the rise of the drug gangs.
Yeah.
Have you experienced that firsthand, like the violence increasing in these drug gangs in London?
Certainly, not specifically drug gangs, but certainly gangs and the knife crime. And there's, to me, there's two very good reasons for it. If you look at the figures, up until about 2013, 2014, knife crime was going down in London. And then 2014, 2015, two things happened. First of all, was the mayoral candidate, Sadiq Khan, said in his election manifesto, if elected, I will do everything in my power to cut Stop and Search. And the second thing, which to me was harebrained stupidity, was a senior officer in the Met, in an attempt to make Stop and Search more targeted and more relevant, declared that any Stop and Search that didn't yield a result, that didn't yield weapons, drugs, stolen property, would be recorded as a negative performance indicator against the officer. So many officers, including me, were like, I am not doing any more Stop and Search. The upshot of this was a short-term gain for long-term pain, which the Met is very good at, or was. The upshot was crime went down because possession of offensive weapons, possession of drugs weren't getting detected. So therefore, the overall crime was going down. Since then, we've only got to look at the news to see what's happened to knife crime. And there's been interviews with disaffected youths, gang members, saying that when they're going out their property, going out on the street, they will check they've got a knife as readily as they'll check they've got a mobile phone because they know the police won't search them. So this tied in the same sort of period with a rise in moped crime, which I was able to personally challenge the commissioner on at one of his meetings. I'd introduced myself as a traffic sergeant I was a tactical pursuit advisor responsible for dealing with crashes after police pursuits. So I was basically in that role. And I said, we are completely impotent, tactically impotent when it comes to dealing with moped crime. As a police officer, I will chase somebody on foot and rugby tackle him and arrest him. And he might get some bumps and scrapes and that's fine. But stick a moped between his legs. And he's got this immunity around him. We can't knock them off. We can't even block the road. If you block the road, there's a moped coming through. You're facing a gross misconduct hearing.
There is nothing we can do. And they know this, and they're laughing at us. And the commissioner was sort of... He responded as I expect him to, which was like, well, we have a duty of care to these people. Mopeds are dangerous things, you know. But new tactics are emerging. I didn't believe him, but he was right. New tactics did emerge, and now you see on the news, mopeds are getting knocked off. They're getting blocked in. These youths are getting arrested. And funnily enough, moped crime went down 50% in the first year. You know, there's no coincidence. Just before I retired, there was this incident in a moped involved in robberies in central London where this is before I spoke to the commissioner, and this is partly what prompted me to speak to the commissioner. The King's Cross one-way system in London, this moped had been involved in several robberies, and the police car had spotted it and given chase. And there's a passerby who had a broken leg. He was on crutches, and he was watching this chase go round and round the one-way system two or three times. On the third attempt, as it came past, he walked into the road using his crutch as a baseball bat and knocked this moped rider off with such shock that the moped rider actually wet his trousers.
Wow.
So I was, because this counts as a collision after a police chase, I was called to the scene to deal with it, and I spoke to this guy. And this guy with the broken leg, he was worried he might be in trouble. And I'm like, no, you're covered by Section 3 of the Criminal Law Act 1977, using reasonable force, which applies to any person, not just a police officer. He said, I'd watch your officers chasing that little twat for 10 minutes. They had ample opportunity to knock him off, ample opportunity to block him in, and they didn't. They just sat behind him and followed him. And I said, that's all they're allowed to do. But that started me thinking. So then when I got called to a commissioner's breakfast meeting, as they were called, I thought, I'm going to do something about this. I was behind the game because he told me that tactics were already being developed for tactical contact and everything. But I like, you know, to think I'd rattle his cage a little bit. Because that's what I was told. Next day, I was called in to see my own chief inspector and said, what the hell have you done? Have you been rattling the commissioner's cage about mopeds? I said, yeah. He said, my bloody phone hasn't stopped ringing all morning. I said, oh, when did your problem become my problem, you know?
Good grief, what a journey.
Yeah, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And for people watching, if you want the journey in much more detail with many, many more stories, check out Cops and Horrors, the book, available worldwide on Amazon.
Amazon, Mirror Books, W.H. Smith, Waterstones, and all usual outlets.
You're everywhere.
It's everywhere, yes. Yeah. 12 different countries.
What led you to write the book then, Matt?
My wife, mainly. My kids, from a very young age, had liked hearing police stories. You know, my wife's heard the stories many times. Then she told me several times, she said, you should write a book. You've got lots of stories, you should write a book. And she'd said this several times, but it was only on the flight back from Cuba 3 years after I'd retired when she's like, for God's sake, just write it down. So I started writing it down and eventually came up with a combination of what I could remember, the stuff that never stayed with me. The Met very kindly sent me my service record with all my commendations, injuries on duty, which helped me do a timeline. British newspaper archives and some Googling. I put together the timeline and the framework of everything that happened. And realised I had a total of 340 stories. So I've put 140 in this book, working with Nicholas Stowe, who's an award-winning ghostwriter, best-selling ghostwriter. So there's fewer than half of the total stories in this book, which may lead to possibility of a sequel, depending on how successful this is. But that would need to be thrashed out with the publisher and the ghostwriter.
I can't see how it cannot succeed after what we've heard today. And
most definitely.
Reading it myself. It is a hair-raising, heartbreaking, at times hilarious autobiography.
I'm so pleased you enjoyed it.
Yes, I really did. Thank you.
I breathe in, exhale, slip my bloody truncheon into its pocket and suddenly realise this is my job for the next 30 years.
Yeah.
So please let us know what you thought about today's video. All the links will be in the description box below. Cheers, Matt. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Yeah.
Good talk. Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
That was well done, Matt. Cheers. Cheers. Yeah, fantastic.
Here at Boomer and Jen, we offer a wide range of organic or recycled clothing, We all know our planet is important. We only have this one. So it's vital that we all work together to slow down and reverse the changes to the environment. Whilst we all know that big industry are having a significant effect on pollution, here at Boomer and Jen, we believe that if we all make small changes, we can do our part. Fast fashion causes detrimental effects to the planet. Not only is nearly 20% of global wastewater produced by the fast fashion industry, but there is a considerable amount of fast fashion ending up in landfill. So let's move away from fast fashion items that are only worn once or twice and start wearing extremely comfortable, durable and environmentally friendly clothing and ethical jewellery. Boomer and Jen was founded in a quiet town in Devon in 2018. It has now gone from strength to strength as the world is becoming more aware of the current climate situation, helping our customers to buy sustainable, quality clothing. All of our products are fair trade and registered with the Global Organic Textiles Standard Association. Check us out on organiccottonclothing.co.uk.
This podcast is sponsored by Gadfly Press. We are proud to announce the publication of Britain's number one art forger, Max Brandert, The Life of a Cheeky Faker. And from the back cover blurb, Max the Forger is an artist and gentleman whose colourful lifestyle has spanned over 70 years. He has lived under the strict regime of Bernardo's Children's Homes, been an elephant handler in the circus, lived rough, busked his way from Brighton to Bombay, sold his fakes up and down the country, dined with dukes, socialised with celebrities, associated with gangsters, served time in prison, and donated tens of thousands to charity. And through it all, he has never stopped smiling and loving life and missing his mum. Quote from the book. Mr. Brandert, I do not see you as a malicious criminal, sighed the judge. But why, oh why, do you continue to use your God-given talent in this way? I just can't help myself, Your Honour. It's like an addiction, I grinned. Available worldwide on Amazon. Link in the description box below this video. Thank you for supporting our sponsor.